Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum and chair of this program. Today we are very pleased to host what will be the Commonwealth Club's fifth program on the subject of biological and health effects of electromagnetic fields. The first program, organized by electromagnetichealth.org, was in 2009, at a time when EMF wasn't even on most people's radar screens as a public health issue. Since then, awareness of the little-known risk of the radiation emitted by cell phones and wireless technologies has certainly greatly increased globally, as has the media coverage, and in the U.S., especially in the Bay Area. Joining me in welcoming today's esteemed international panel from the U.S., U.K., Turkey, and Australia are four of the club's member-led forums: Health and Medicine, Environment and Natural Resources, Science and Technology, and Business and Leadership. We are grateful for the efforts of electromagnetichealth.org and Environmental Health Trust in assuring that the latest science and its health and well-being implications are brought to the attention of the public. The issue is getting more and more important as the body of science showing our risk accumulates and more wireless pervades our daily life. As before, today's program will be filmed and shared globally. Today's program has a special and very important focus on children. It has become clear that cell phones and wireless technologies pose greater health risks to children, and that overuse of technology can impact learning, and thus grades, relationships, and the ability even to empathize. I welcome you to today's program, and now I turn the reins over to Camilla Rees of electromagnetichealth.org and Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools.
Thank you very much, Bill. Good morning, everyone. My colleague, Lord Morgan of Environmental Health Trust, and I welcome you here today. I'm really grateful that we have the sponsorship of four of the Commonwealth Club's member-led forums. This is the first time we've had four: Health and Medicine, Environment and Natural Resources, Science and Technology, and Business and Leadership. We are very grateful for the collaboration of the California Brain Tumor Association, Citizens for Health, and the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. We are so pleased to have with us today experts, a lineup of physicians, a child psychiatrist, EMF scientists from five countries in all, offering diverse expertise and perspectives on this important issue of electromagnetic fields in children. The video from today's program, we hope, will travel into as many countries as it has in the past, 170 countries, millions and millions of views. So we are excited about this opportunity and really grateful to the Commonwealth Club. If you would, please see the panelists' bios that are on your seats, and because in the interest of time and maximizing the educational value of today's program, we're not going to be reading them. Today, we're going to be focusing on how children are being impacted by the proliferation of cell phones and wireless technologies, including Wi-Fi in schools, and the current state of the EMF science showing risk, with the overarching question of, are the present cell phone and wireless safety guidelines adequate to protect children, or should they be strengthened? 4 years ago, in 2011, the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer, or IARC, classified the radiation as a possible carcinogen. While cancer risk is very important, and today we're going to be hearing about new research modeling brain radiation absorption in the brains of children, and also about the increased incidence of tumors, there are biological effects from this radiation well beyond cancer, effects that impact children in the here and now, in their schools, in their homes, while they're doing their homework, and while they sleep. And this is why we're here today. Pope Francis, as many of you heard recently, he made the headlines globally, calling climate change one of the most important moral issues facing society. He said, "I would like to enter into a dialogue with all people about our common home." And repeatedly, he called on humans to protect creation. Today, Electromagnetic Health and Environmental Health Trust seek to enter into a dialogue about our common home in the interest of protecting the sanctity of children's lives, the lives of people who will eventually be the leaders of our society, and ultimately who will continue the human race. Over 200 scientists from 39 countries recently signed an appeal to the United Nations calling for leadership on electromagnetic fields and specifically calling for the protection of children. Dr. Joel Moskowitz from UC Berkeley, who was one of the key organizers of that appeal, we look forward to hearing from him later when we're in the talk about policy. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge and give a very warm welcome to City Councilman Max Anderson from Berkeley, California. Please stand if you would. This man was a driving force in seeing that Berkeley require visible warnings for cell phones at the point of sale. He is the epitome of a true public servant who worked on this issue consistently over many years to finally see reason and responsibility hold sway. Now to start, I'm going to play a video that accompanied the appeal to the United Nations by international scientists. It's a 3-minute video. And also I just want to acknowledge and express my gratitude to Elizabeth Kelly, who was the initiator of the appeal, who can't be with us here today. We've had tremendous amount of media coverage all around the world for this, and so far over 500,000 views of the video. So let me find it.
I'm here with disturbing news about our favorite gadgets, cell phones, tablets, Wi-Fi, etc. Putting it bluntly, they are damaging the living cells in our bodies and killing many of us prematurely. I'm Dr. Martin Blank from the Department of Physiology and Cellular Biophysics at Columbia University. It is distressing for me and more than 160 colleagues who today are petitioning the United Nations requesting that they address this problem. We are scientists and engineers, and I am here to tell you we have created something that is harming us, and it is getting out of control. Before Edison's light bulb, there was very little electromagnetic radiation in our environment. The levels today are very many times higher than natural background levels and are growing rapidly because of all the new devices that emit this radiation. An example that a lot of us have in our pockets right now is the cell phone. One study shows that as cell phone usage has spread widely, the incidence of fatal brain cancer in younger people has more than tripled. We are putting cellular antennas on residential buildings and on top of hospitals where people are trying to get well. Wireless utility meters and cell towers are blanketing our neighborhoods with radiation. It's particularly frightening that radiation from our telecommunication and power line technology is damaging the DNA in our cells. It is clear to many biologists that this can account for the rising cancer rates. Future generations, our children, are at risk. These biologists and scientists are not being heard on the committees that set safety standards. The biological facts are being ignored, and as a result, the safety limits are much too high. They are not protective. More protection will probably result from full disclosure of possible conflicts of interest between regulators and industry. Rising exposure to electromagnetic radiation is a global problem. The World Health Organization and international standard-setting bodies are not acting to protect the public's health and well-being. International exposure guidelines for electromagnetic fields must be strengthened to reflect the reality of their impact on our bodies, and in particular, on our DNA. Although we are still in the midst of a great technological transformation, the time to deal with the harmful biological and health effects is long overdue. We are really all part of a large biological experiment without our informed consent. To protect our children, ourselves, and our ecosystem, we must reduce exposure by establishing more protective guidelines. And so today, scientists from around the world are submitting an appeal to the United Nations, its member states, and the World Health Organization to provide leadership in dealing with this emerging public health crisis.
Oops, sorry. So today, the first panel, we'll have Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe from the United Kingdom, who will review the biological and health effects of electromagnetic fields, discuss the exposure guidelines, and also talk about the special vulnerabilities of children. Then we'll have Dr. Carl Merritt, who is going to talk about give us insight into the typical RF environment in a school and the variability of these exposures. and a sense of the cumulative of exposures over a day, and which may be a better gauge of risk. And then we'll have Victoria Dunkley, who's a child psychiatrist, and she's going to talk about how overstimulation and dysregulation by electronics mimics or exacerbates numerous psychiatric conditions, and how the radiation from wireless communications magnifies these effects. And after this panel, we'll have Lloyd Morgan introduce the second panel, and then we'll have a break. So, Dr. Mallory Blythe.
Thank you for that warm welcome. So I'm Erica Mallory Blythe. It's a sad state of affairs when parents, scientists, and medical doctors are on their knees to politicians and salesmen begging for protection for the health of our children. You'll see a long list of groups that have appealed, and they're rich in both quality and quantity. So this is a rapid 15-minute presentation, and I'm going to overview some common misconceptions regarding the use of non-ionizing radiation at non-thermal levels, with a focus on vulnerable groups. So common devices that use this kind of radiation are numerous and rapidly increasing, but commonly mobile, telecommunications, etc. Life is electromagnetic. That's how we work. That's how all life works. So it should be no surprise that these fields are having biological effect. But some try to allay concerns by saying, well, we evolved in an electromagnetic field, so it can't possibly be affecting us negatively. And that's true, we did evolve in a field, but it bears no resemblance to the one that we have recently created. The one that we now commonly see is broad-ranging, but can be up to a quintillion times higher, 10 to the 18. So the power density is dramatically different. But in addition to that, the characteristics of that radiation are also different. You can see in green there the natural background radiation and how it dips at about 1 gigahertz. And that is the very part of the spectrum that we've filled in with this anthropogenic or man-made radiation. And you can see in yellow the 1950s, orange the 80s, and then 2010 how it peaks there in red at high signal strengths in this relatively quiet area of the spectrum. And this happened really fast. In evolutionary terms, this is the blink of an eye or the beat of a heart, less than one person's lifetime. So it's not seen one generation from cradle to grave. But one would hope that safety limits are in place to protect us, and unfortunately they are not, not in this country and not where I currently reside in the UK. The reason I say that is because we are using something called the ICNIRP guidelines, and they were designed to protect against thermal effects only. That means tissue heating. We know that there are many non-thermal effects that occur orders of magnitude below those levels. And don't take my word for that. This is from the United States Environmental Protection Agency. The last line you'll see states, the generalization by many that the guidelines protect human beings by harm from all or any mechanisms is not justified. So many countries have lowered their guidelines to try to be more biologically protective. And even in these countries, those very low limits are still being criticized as not being low enough because there is scientific evidence of effects even below those levels, which are much lower than ours in the UK and here in the US. But some still argue that non-thermal effects haven't been adequately proven or that we need more science, more research. I would dispute that on the basis of this, that there are tens of thousands of research papers now. Of course, there is some inconsistency. We would expect that when we're looking at non-linear biological systems being observed in different labs all over the world. But the majority do demonstrate harm. And when I say the majority, it's around 70% of unbiased literature. And that's reflected here in these studies. You can see in blue, it's hovering around the 70% mark that's showing impact to biology in all groups, not just humans, but plants and animals as well. Some people separate out Wi-Fi and mistakenly think that that is so weak that can't be affecting us. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And to put that in perspective, if you stand about 100 meters from a mobile phone base station, you might be in the beam of greatest intensity. And so you are in this case, looking at that signal strength on the left there. And you can compare that with emissions from a Wi-Fi-enabled laptop. That's actually at 50 centimetres, that's half a metre. Many children will use that much, much closer. And you can see the signal strengths, though, are still higher, and that could be an underestimation. So you can't move that laptop any further away or you wouldn't be able to use it. But some people instinctively think, well, we'll push the routers further away and that might be protective by dropping the intensity. And that will drop the intensity, but I'm not convinced that we can call that protective. And the reason I say that is because intensity windows exist where for a lower intensity of radiation, it can have a greater or more dramatic biological effect. In addition to that, biological impact is dependent on a great variety of different parameters, not just intensity. All of these other factors, including at the bottom there, the vulnerability of that individual, who is not like the routers that came off the production line, they're all very different. And we'll talk about that for a moment. Some people sort of say, well, if it caused all this damage, we'd all be ill. And a few are concerned that we are all becoming ill, and this is the World Health Organization predicting, I quote from them, a tidal wave of cancer. And you can see the distribution of that in dark blue, which I find interesting. In addition, lots of other disorders, and this is looking at autistic spectrum disorders. And it's interesting how the curve of incidence follows the ambient increase in RF. Now, I wouldn't insult you by implying that this graph alone means anything, because it doesn't. We can create graphs like this from almost any data. However, there are peer-reviewed published papers that are consolidating our concerns looking at this link and many other disease processes. So, of course, we wouldn't expect everyone to become ill at the same time. We know that not everyone who smokes a cigarette gets lung cancer, but we do know that there are people who are more vulnerable and therefore may become ill more rapidly. Children are more vulnerable for lots of different reasons, and these are just a few. Their skulls are thinner, so they have less bone shielding of their brain, and their brains contain a higher water content, particularly in the really young neonates. They're smaller. Their systems are still developing, and they have stem cells which are exquisitely sensitive to this kind of radiation. They have a longer time ahead of them for some of the delayed or latent effects that can be decades after exposure. And a five-year-old can absorb up to 60% more microwave radiation, and exposures in their bone marrow can be up to 10 times greater. So, very sensibly, some governments have issued warnings, and this is one from the UK, stating children and young people under 16 shouldn't be using their phones except for essential calls. And that's very sensible. However, we don't, in the UK, currently have the same caution for tablet use, which I don't understand, because tablets are not necessarily less powerful. You can see here that when you're looking at SAR, which is actually a poor measure of impact, but it's what's being used at the moment, the SAR, or specific absorption rate from a smartphone, can certainly be comparable with, or in some cases, less than that from a tablet. Some schools feel under pressure and feel that they need to use wireless internet to be competitive in information technology education. Well, firstly, I draw your attention to the UN Convention on the Rights of a Child. I think, personally, that the use of this kind of radiation in the classroom is in direct violation of this convention. And it talks here about the best interests of children, making them a top priority, with an emphasis on health, saying that they have the right to the best possible health. Not some kind of compromise, but the best possible health, and a clean environment. And these days, as a parent, if your child is going to be taken on a trip or anything really that could involve safeguarding issues or health and safety, you're asked to sign a consent form. And if you wanted to sign a consent form for something like this, it might read, I consent to my child being irradiated by a group 2B possible human carcinogen, exposed to a toxin shown in peer-reviewed published scientific studies to cause DNA damage and other biological disruptions such as, and there's a very long list, this is just a few that I've picked out. Personally, I would not be comfortable signing that form. And if you're not either, then all of us need to be rethinking the use of these devices in school. So I would emphasise that wireless radiation is not necessary for an IT department in a school. You can give your child a very full education by using hardwired alternatives. And France has banned Wi-Fi in under threes and limits its use for under sixes. Vive la France! Electromagnetic hypersensitivity. So some children may also have this condition, making them additionally vulnerable. And this is a condition hallmarked by a broad range of symptoms, including headaches, dizziness, palpitations, mood disturbance, concentrational problems, etc., in response to these types of fields and some others. And there's a huge number of misconceptions about this issue. So some, and I've even heard doctors say this, which is really unforgivable, have said, oh, it has so many symptoms, it can't be real. And that's ridiculous. We only have to look at ionizing radiation sickness to see that that is how radiation works. It affects every system of our body. It's actually corroborating evidence, not against. Others will say that EHS is so rare they don't need to worry about it. But estimates vary between 4 and 10%, and extrapolated figures suggest that this is rising quickly, and some have suggested that 50% of the population may be affected by 2017. So this is not rare. In addition, some people think, well, my symptoms can't be EHS because perhaps your doctor has diagnosed you with something else or you've taken medication and it's fixed the problem. That does not necessarily mean that the cause of it wasn't radiation. So we need to have a second look at that. Doctors are not well educated on this subject, through no fault of their own in general. And others are saying that EHS is caused by the nocebo effect, or symptoms induced by fear. The nocebo effect is real. It can happen in a number of circumstances in life, but it is not relevant to true EHS. It is not caused by the nocebo effect. There's a great long list of reasons for that, and I'd love to explore them, but we don't have time today. But feel free, please, to ask me questions about that at the end. And these are some of the figures you'll see along the top there for that we're looking at for a very large number of people being affected by these kinds of symptoms. So I mentioned that this is a group 2B, or possible human carcinogen. This has been belittled many times, and certainly a lot of people are saying, but the risk isn't nearly as serious as with x-rays or smoking. Well, this is the COMET assay that looks at DNA damage, and you can assess quantitatively damage by looking at the length and density of the COMET-like tail there. On the left, you'll see that sham where there is no toxic exposure, that's healthy DNA. In the middle, that's gamma irradiation equivalent to about 1,600 chest x-rays, so alarming, possibly carcinogenic doses. And you compare that with just 24 hours of mobile phone radiation below current allowable guidelines. You can see that actually that looks extremely comparable. In addition, thank you to my colleague Sarah Starkey, who's done some excellent work here looking at the odds ratios from time from first use comparing tobacco and lung cancer with mobile phone and head tumours. And you can see that looking at time from first use, those are really comparable odds ratios. So we need to take that seriously also. In addition, some of the International Agency for Research on Cancer scientists have called for this to be classed as a group one. And this is a paper from Leonard Hardell and colleagues pointing that out, that this fulfills the Hill criteria for causality. So we should be classifying this again as a class one, which would put it in the same group as tobacco, smoking and x-rays. So I think it's time to really stop denying that we need to take this threat very seriously. Some think mistakenly that cancer is the only documented health concern, and it's not. There are loads, again, beyond the scope of this lecture, but this is a list I've put together. And there are mechanisms that explain these links, and I'm really looking forward to a lecture from one of my colleagues, Martin Paul, later on talking about calcium influx into cells. I'll leave that to him. And there are other mechanisms also described. So there are lots of pathways likely, same as with carcinogenicity, for example. But some people are left in disbelief, really, and think this can't be true. If it was true, then somebody would be telling us. We don't need to look back very far to see that the public were not warned in a timely fashion before. And it's time not to repeat our foolish mistakes of the past. And I really don't want people to feel despondent and that there's nothing they can do because it's everywhere. Because you can use the power that you have to change the things that you cannot accept. You can start by reducing exposure to the things that are within your own personal environment. But I would suggest that that is a bit of a half measure. Reducing exposure could be seen like smoking a low-tar cigarette. And if we're looking at vulnerable groups and defensible protection, we should be looking at eliminating these fields from our children's environments, immediately using airplane mode, etc., and replacing with hardwired alternatives. All children have a right to a healthy environment at school. They're often non-consenting and potentially non-benefiting parties. So the precautionary principle is really outdated now. It's overdue, and protection is an emergency. And adults as well. Everyone should have the right to avoid exposure to something with this level of health threat, should they wish. So in summary, we're electromagnetic. That's how we work. It should be absolutely no surprise that these fields are interfering with health, and present safety standards are not protective. Individuals can lower their exposure, and you can request governmental action. We need to be protecting vulnerable groups as an emergency. This presentation is dedicated to Jennifer Victoria Elizabeth Fry. Jenny took her life by hanging just over 1 week ago. This followed a long, lengthy set of correspondence from her parents to the school, to the local education authority, and to their local MP, who happened to be David Cameron, Prime Minister of the UK. They had been campaigning for 2 years to try and have Wi-Fi removed from Jenny's environment because they were utterly convinced it was damaging her health, both physically and psychologically. Parents should not be forced to choose between educating their child and safeguarding them. There is science to back up these parents' concerns, and they're part of an ever-growing number. I feel really privileged to be here at an establishment that forever will be dignified by the wise words of Martin Luther King. There comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular. But he must take it because conscience tells him that is right. Thank you so much.
It's different
on a PC than on that. Full screen, there it is. Okay, got it. Okay. Do you need the clicker? Or you can use
I
this?
I can use that. Well, thank you very much for inviting me this morning for this brief talk on what we started to look at, which is how much exposure is the child getting. And in this case, it's a preliminary examination of a hypersensitive, electronically or electromagnetically hypersensitive child. And there are many sources of microwave radiation, so we'll just concentrate on the Wi-Fi in schools, which is also in our homes, in our places of like coffee shops and so on. Dr. William Ray said that sensitivity to electromagnetic radiation is the emerging health problem of the 21st century. It is imperative that health practitioners, government, schools, and parents learn more about it. And he studies electromagnetically hypersensitive children and people. And it's estimated that in California, that's about 3% of our population. So that would be 140,000 kids in our schools and over a million Californians. And these numbers are conservative, I believe. They go up. So we started to use a German dosimeter that can measure many, many frequencies simultaneously. You wear it on your arm, as you can see in the picture here. It's very lightweight, easy to do. You just turn it on, and you can record every half second for 24 hours what different frequencies you're being exposed to. And the good thing about this dosimeter, it's the only one I know in the world, it actually measures the field right around your whole body, as you can see in this graphic. The radiation that you're exposed to comes into your body from the side where the radiation sources are located, but it travels around your body. Some of it is absorbed, some of it wraps around your body, some of it is reflected. So you need to do the proper modeling to do that. And here's a graph showing the various frequencies. We're concerned in the far right, you can see 2.45 gigahertz. That's where the Wi-Fi operates. And we studied this in a school where there was also a 5 gigahertz signal. So there's a 2.4, like your microwave oven operates, and then the Wi-Fi and many, many other devices. So we have this problem not only in schools, but in our homes, as you've just heard. And remember, none of these things were ever tested for health effects. They were basically unleashed onto the public thinking because they don't heat up tissue, there shouldn't be a problem. You also have to understand this is a picture showing that Wi-Fi has been evolving. The first Wi-Fi came out in 1997. That was the first generation. We're up to the fifth generation now, which uses totally different modulation technologies. It uses multiple antennas. It does beamforming, sending signals where you want. It has to put more and more data through the system because everybody wants to download a video in 6 minutes or something like that. So we have no continuous health monitoring of these newer forms of Wi-Fi, and we're into what's called 802.11ac now, which is fifth generation, just released in 2012. So we carried out some preliminary measurements in a school on the East Coast in February and March on 5 different days on a child that was very sensitive because we wanted to know, was there a correlation between his frequent headaches and one's inability to even stay in school because of these symptoms and the exposure. This was a 12-year-old child. Now, you have to understand that most of these digital technologies by nature are pulsing. And so they have very many peak pulses, but what they often do is to give you averages, averaging over it, because averaging is important when you have heat exposure. How long are you essentially radiating an area? But the peak pulses are much, much more intense, and that's what we're monitoring here. So this is data from an exposure in March of this child, and the green dotted line, I don't know, it's easy to see here, but that's what we use as the safety exposure guideline, which is called the Bioinitiative Indoor Exposure Safety Guidelines of about 100 microwatts per square meter. And you can see in different classes, in different rooms, there was higher exposure, and we averaged that over just to see what those peaks are over 10 minutes and so on. So you can just kind of see these red bars. And you can see in certain classes, this child was really having a lot more exposure to radiation than he was getting in his home room, say, or in his study hall. And here's another example, and this was a very short exposure because the child got very sick and had to leave the school that day. Now, these numbers just show the variability of the Wi-Fi signal that the children are being exposed to, and they're very high. What I did then is something that nobody's really doing is look at the cumulative exposure over time, and you can see that on the top little graphs here. It'll be easier to see on the videos, I'm sure, later. But the degree of slope of the accumulation of this wireless signal over time will be perhaps be a much better measure over time. And we can compare this cumulative exposure to what we would recommend the child should not be exposed to over a certain time period. So then we can compare, and these graphs basically just show bars, and it tells you how many minutes is the child overall during a school day exceeding the safety guideline, and that's 24 minutes, 30 minutes, but on the difficult days, 46 and 42 minutes. So as part of an 8-hour school day or a 6-hour school day, that's a significant amount, and many times the child comes home with headaches under these conditions. Now, to make some sense out of this, you really have to compare this also to levels we're all exposed to. So I measured in coffee shops at low intensity at the top graph there, and you can see that depending on where you sit in the coffee shop, close you are to the router or the hotspot, there may be not so much exposure, and at the bottom, when you sit very close to where the actual router is in the coffee shop, you might get a much higher exposure. But now compare that to the school readings at the top. And at the bottom, you see coffee shop at low levels, and there you can see that curve on the right, the cumulative exposure, and these are just over a 7-minute period comparing the same, and you can see it's much, much more over in the school. And even if you compare it to a high-intensity output in a coffee shop sitting near the router, you can still see that school was, in this particular case, even higher. And so that becomes worrisome because we have magnetite crystals in our brain coverings called the meninges, and it's also in the brain tissue, and this directly absorbs Wi-Fi. So we have these little crystals of magnetite. It's a form of iron that absorbs that. And when you think about that, we nowadays produce baby monitors, which essentially also work at 2.4 gigahertz, the same as Wi-Fi, and they work at the DECT cordless telephone frequency of 1.9 gigahertz. And we stick these right next to the little babies. It becomes a little worrisome. These are the top-selling baby monitors from Amazon. All of them use wireless radiation that you're exposing your child to. So the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2013 wrote a letter to the FCC and said, I think we should change the standards. We urge a re-examination of the wireless exposure standards. Canadian doctors are concerned about that. In the Canadian Medical Association Journal, you see write-ups about the federal Wi-Fi panel being criticized because of undisclosed conflicts of interest and being a disaster for public health. And even the California Medical Association seeks new standard for microwaves. You may not be aware that in 2014, in December 7th, the California Medical Association seeks a new wireless standard, and specifically the wording is, whereas peer-reviewed research has demonstrated adverse biological effects of wireless EMFs, including single and double-strand DNA breaks, creation of reactive oxygen species. These are essentially free radicals. It's like rusting prematurely. That's reactive oxygen species, immune dysfunction, cognitive processing effects, stress protein synthesis in the brain, altered brain development, sleep and memory disturbances, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, abnormal behavior, sperm dysfunction, and brain tumors. And this is from the California Medical Association asking for a new examination of our exposure standards. So since 2006, some schools in the UK have tried to have worried about health effects and tried to dismantle the wireless networks. And we really need to apply the precautionary principle here, which is essentially, if we don't have all the answers, let's at least start studying this. And my conclusions to this would be, we really need dosimetry studies, the kinds I've showed you here, in order to find out how much radiation are we being exposed to so that our children are safe to use wired systems whenever possible, fiber optic or Ethernet cables, and, you know, really start looking at these peak exposure levels rather than averaging everything down and telling you it's safe. I believe that it really isn't. And the electromagnetically hypersensitive children and adults are the canary in the coal mines that basically say, we have a problem here, it's time to address it. Thank you very much.
That was excellent. What a great team we have here today. Yep.
Okay, I'm Dr. Victoria Dunkley. I am an integrative child psychiatrist, and integrative practitioners look at lifestyle factors both to optimize treatment and also to reduce the need for pharmaceutical medication. So for the last 10 years or so, I've been really focused on restricting electronics use in children because I find that out of all the lifestyle interventions, it provides the most dramatic benefits by far and away. So I'm just going to go over kind of what's going on right now with kids and some of the symptoms that are caused by screen time and the physiology of what actually happens when kids use electronics. So just to clarify, these are effects that are above and beyond the radiation effects. And also, I tend to focus more on interactive screen time, so things like video gaming, internet use, anytime kids are interacting with a device, smartphones, iPads. Okay, so currently there's several disturbing trends that are on the rise in children. For psychiatric disorders, there's been an increase in ADHD, autism has exploded, tics, Tourette syndrome, bipolar disorder, all of those are on the rise, or at least diagnosis of them. At the same time, more and more kids are being put on medication, particularly stimulants, which are used for attention, and antipsychotics, which are used for all sorts of things, including tics, mood swings, sleep problems, autism. And the antipsychotics have serious short-term and long-term side effects. So that's particularly disturbing. So also at the same time, there's increase in obesity, high blood pressure, other medical conditions that we didn't used to see in kids at all. Disability filings for psychological, psychiatric, and neurological conditions. And then there's some drops in IQ and achievement measures that we're seeing, particularly in boys. So boys are really falling off the curve, and currently in colleges right now, it's a 2-to-1 ratio of women to men. So meanwhile, while all this is going on, kids' electronics use has skyrocketed, and this is not a surprise to anybody. Currently, it's at 5 to 7 hours a day for the average child. Exposure is occurring at increasingly younger ages, including toddlers and even babies. And now school is getting into the game. So aside from homework, they're using interactive whiteboards, and they're also using software to teach. So what do we already know about the screen time risk? Well, we actually know quite a lot. We know that screen time is associated with medical conditions, mental health issues, sleep problems, social problems, delinquency, addiction, both tech addiction and other addictions, as well as learning problems and developmental issues. So that begs the question, why aren't we more strict about how much exposure children are getting? The reason is because there's a lot of misconceptions that are perpetuated in our society about electronics use. So there's a lot of myths, and these are actually not the myths, but I'm going to go over the truths, the facts. Okay, so first, total screen time is a much better predictor of problems than the type. So content doesn't matter as much as people say. So a lot of people are focused on whether the content is educational or violent or not. That doesn't matter as much as the amount of screen time. Interactive screen time is actually more problematic than passive screen time like television. So that's another myth, because a lot of parents will restrict television viewing, but they'll let their kid use the iPad as much as they want. But interactive screen time is actually more addicting. It's more likely to cause sleep issues, behavior problems, and mood problems. So another issue is that the everything in moderation mentality doesn't always apply. So some kids can't tolerate any screen time. I work with a lot of kids who are on the autism spectrum, as well as ADHD, and some of them, they have 15 minutes of iPad use and they're already dysregulated. So everything in moderation, we can't always assume that's true. In school, studies show that computer skills are overemphasized, but they're actually relatively easy to learn, even for kids with disabilities, so there's no reason why we should be spending so much time teaching them. Software education, there's no evidence that it's superior to any other types of learning, so it's at best neutral, and it's probably harmful. And an example is electronic reading. So studies show that when reading from a screen actually hinders literacy, so it hinders kids' ability or learning how to read, and also their reading comprehension. And that's actually true for adults, too. They don't read as the comprehension is impaired when you read from a screen. So another example is taking notes by hand is actually superior to taking notes with a laptop, and that's true for memory, integrating the material, and even exam performance. So in general, the nature of technology itself is at odds with basic developmental needs. So kids need eye contact, they need face-to-face conversation with adults, They need movement, and they need exposure to the outdoors and nature. And those are all the things that are getting reduced by technology in the classroom. So one way to think about screen time is that anything with a screen, it acts like a stimulant. So a stimulant being things like caffeine, cocaine, amphetamines, those are all stimulants. And we know kids can't tolerate caffeine, especially if they have any kind of vulnerability. So if you just think of it as a nervous system irritant. So that means all screen time, including educational, actually stresses the nervous system. And every time a kid picks up a screen, they actually go into a little bit of fight or flight each time. So that just ends up just regulating the nervous system. So if we look at the different factors that actually cause this fight or flight state, there's multiple things that induce it. So the first is that reward pathways get activated. And these are pathways that are meant to be activated to a small extent normally, but if they're activated repeatedly, they actually become desensitized. And the main brain chemical that's involved in these pathways, dopamine, is also gets out of balance. So sometimes there's some evidence that dopamine doesn't work as well, or it's overactive in some areas and less active in others, and that might be the root of a lot of the problems. Since the sensory system gets overloaded, so visually the colors on a screen are much brighter, more vivid, there's usually more movement, so all that rapid and intense sensory stimulation increases stress. The light from the screen tends to be blue-toned or white, and it's unnaturally bright, so that increases stress levels and also suppresses melatonin, which is what we need to sleep. So only just a little bit of screen stimulation for kids especially suppresses their melatonin for hours. Multitasking goes hand in hand with electronics use. So kids are multitasking when they're Skyping and doing their homework, but it's also happening at school. And that actually depletes mental reserves, and it impairs performance, and it impairs their attention over time as well. And then the interactivity itself actually causes hyperarousal in and of itself. And then, of course, radiation causes stress at the cellular level as well as the systemic level. So how do all those stress reactions turn into symptoms? Well, when the brain is stressed and overstimulated, what happens is the blood flow becomes shunted from the front part of the brain or the higher thinking parts of the brain to the more primitive parts of the brain. The body clock becomes desynchronized. Brain chemistry and hormones are all altered. Beatrice is calling.
I'm just kidding.
Beatrice?
This isn't helpful.
No.
Can you hear us? We are in the middle of a presentation. We'll call you on the break.
I can't have them on.
Okay, then, yeah, that was the only reason we were trying this for you.
No, I wanted to try. I thought they had a way.
Strange. So sorry. which way was your...
Can you just minimize it?
There we go.
Okay. Yeah. So there we have an example. Manifested just for the talk here. Okay, so anyway, so you can see when kids start operating from a more primitive part of the brain and the frontal lobe is suppressed, everything the frontal lobe does suffers. So the frontal lobe controls emotional regulation, it controls executive function, so attention, getting things done, controls impulse control, empathy, and creativity. So when the child becomes overstimulated, they tend to have problems with mood, cognition, and behavior. So their mood, they become dysregulated, they're irritable, they can't calm down if they're mad. They tend to have meltdowns over little things, you know, so you can see them having meltdowns on the playground, at home. Cognitively, they have poor focus, they can't get their act together. Even if they do their homework, they forget to turn it in. And parents complain that they, you know, have trouble getting ready for school or getting ready for bed. And then in some kids, they actually can become psychotic. I've worked with multiple children that have become paranoid or actually start hallucinating from using screens, and it actually goes away when you get rid of them. So, and behaviorally, they tend to be more, they become defiant because they just, they can't think. They can't control themselves, and they have low empathy, so they misread social cues and things like that. So all sorts of problems. So you can see if all of these frontal lobe functions are suffering, you can see how virtually any kind of psychiatric or neurological disorder can be either mimicked or exacerbated. So some kids, when you remove electronics, everything goes away, and other kids, they still have the disorder, but it's much better. So what's happening is kids are getting misdiagnosed, they're being inappropriately medicated, and the cost of that is that we're misusing resources. So both in the mental health and in the educational realms, we're struggling already in these realms, and these are expensive problems to treat, so it doesn't make any sense to use them inefficiently. Okay, so in contrast, if you restrict electronics, all of those things, we have the opposite effect. So what I do with every single child I see, the first time I see them, is I put them on a strict, extended 3 to 4 week electronic fast. So all interactive screen time, I eliminate. I let them, they can watch a little bit of TV, but everything else is not allowed. And that helps them, it helps reset the nervous system so their brain is allowed to rest for several weeks and everything resets. So stress levels lower, their brain chemistry rebalances, and hormones, including stress hormones, are better regulated. So what this does is it clarifies the diagnosis. It optimizes other treatments. So sometimes the child's been in therapy and it hasn't been working. All of a sudden, it starts working. Or they're getting tutoring in math or something, and all of a sudden, their tutoring starts to progress. At the same time, it minimizes the need for medication, so even if a child does need medication, the dose will be lower. And it also provides a baseline for how much they can tolerate. So every kid will have like a tipping point where they start to become dysregulated and everything kind of goes out of whack. But once they're reset, then you can really systematically determine how much they can tolerate. So when they, if parents reintroduce anything, I have them do it very slowly and methodically. So I'm going to go over a couple cases. The first is Sophia. She's a 15-year-old girl with autism and ADHD. She was stable for several years on two different medications. One of them was just as needed for agitation. So she came in recently and had gained 12 pounds in 3 months. And she was shrieking, hitting her mom, hitting herself in the head, crying, and this, I hadn't seen her like that since I first saw her years before. So what happened, so during the session, the mother actually handed her her smartphone, and I asked the mother, how long have you been giving her that, and she just said, for a couple months, and I said, why, because this is a family that didn't allow video games, and she said the reason she was allowing it was because Sophia was using the iPad at school, so she thought it was okay. So it turned out that the iPad program at school had also started a couple months earlier. So then we figured out that the weight gain was actually because the mother was giving her more medication because she was more agitated. So you can see how these problems snowball. So we had the mother eliminate the smartphone use. That reduced the symptoms. And then we worked with the school to actually stop the iPad program, which is harder to do than you might think, but they eventually worked with us. And once we did that, her symptoms resolved and she actually lost the weight. Another case is Ryan. At the time he was 8 years old. He was a good student, no mental health symptoms, but all of a sudden in second grade, his grades started falling. He became depressed. He stopped being interested in learning anything, and his teachers were complaining. So his mother took him to several psychiatrists and therapists. He first got diagnosed with ADHD, then depression, and then finally with autism because they couldn't figure out what was going on. He was prescribed multiple medications, and he was receiving services at home and at school, and he still wasn't getting better. This is just a colleague of mine, by the way, her son. So when I spoke to the mother, Ryan had been playing video games daily, and she had been given, or he had been given a smartphone 1 year before. So I told her to try the fast, the electronic fast. She did it for 4 weeks, and Ryan's mood improved. He started playing with his friends again. He started sleeping better. His grades went up, and he was back to himself. So the mother was so impressed that she continued to restrict video games, or didn't allow them, and didn't allow him to have a phone either. So that was 2 years ago. So 2 years later, he's still doing well. He's not on any medication, no services, happy child. So you can see this is a child that really didn't have anything wrong with him, but ended up looking quite ill. And this kind of a case happens all the time. So the recommendations.
Deborah, we're in the middle of the presentation. We'll call you in a few minutes.
Can you tell me how many, please?
5 or 6.
Bye-bye.
Okay. So the recommendations are really that we just need to pace technology, introducing technology to kids based on developmental needs and not what we think they should know, and also individual needs. So some children just can't tolerate it. So if we do that, we actually protect their frontal lobe, and the frontal lobe is what helps them use technology in a healthy way in the first place. So ironically, reducing exposure now will help them use it more productively later. We need to be able to use these fast. It's a free, easy, effective thing to do. And then we can reintroduce slowly as tolerated. If we use wired-only access for internet access, that automatically reduces accessibility, and obviously it reduces radiation as well. And then for school, we really need to parents need to be allowed to opt their children out of iPad and laptop programs, and ask for other tech-related accommodations, such as not having light at night, which is the research on light at night is terrifying. So I always encourage parents to ask for accommodations, even if they don't get them. The more times that parents ask, the more likely eventually it'll be easier for everybody to ask. So I wrote Reset Your Child's Brain to explain the science better and also to give more guidance in managing screen time systematically. And there's a flyer over there. The book is, you can pre-order it now, but it'll be released on July 21st. So thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you to her panel one. We're now going to change the guard here, and Lloyd Morgan from Environmental Health Trust will be moderating the next panel. We'll have Q&A at the end with all the panelists, except for the two that are going to be Skyped in today, including Dr. Deborah Davis, who will be the first speaker on the current program. Could we have Dr. Nesrin and Martin Paul also? Who else is on this panel? And Martin Paul and Nesrin Sehan. I guess we don't need an extra seat. Okay, so let's get. Okay, so when you're ready for Deborah, I'll sit right here to help you, okay? You're going to click on that button that's going to call her.
Okay.
And she will be on, and then I'll sit right here, and we'll help make sure it gets up on the screen.
Great.
Okay.
This is the beginning of panel two. My name is Lloyd Morgan. I'm a senior research fellow with Environmental Health Trust. As you've just seen, an excellent series of presentations. I think it was pretty amazing. The next panel is going to address the latest in EMF science, showing risk of cell phones and wireless technologies, importantly, the mechanisms for action, and the adequacy of the International Agency for Research in Cancer, called IARC, which has declared electromagnetic radiation a possible human carcinogen, a group 2B carcinogen. The speakers are Dr. Deborah Davis via Skype, Professor Martin Paul, and Dr. Nezrin Sehan from Turkey. So you can check your bios for their backgrounds. The theme of this session is, what is the latest EMF science telling us about the risk of action and the adequacy of the IARC warning? In May of 2011, the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research in Cancer, IARC, declared radiofrequency radiation a group 2B carcinogen. That's a possible carcinogen. In the 4 years since the declaration, there have been many additional studies published. Looking only at the epidemiological studies for brain cancer and a hearing nerve tumor called an acoustic neuroma, there have been 6 studies published in those 4 years since. There are multiple other studies, of course, including cell studies, scientifically we call that in vitro, animal studies we call in vivo, and studies on sperm damage, both in vitro, in vivo, and in humans. Brain cancer. In July 2011, just 8 weeks after the IARC warning, a multi-country European study did a study of children. The median age was 13, and they reported a 118% increased risk of brain cancer after only 2.8 years or more of use. And this was based on billing records. One of the big problems in epidemiology, people remember their past use. This was the past use they actually had. And there was a dose-response relationship, which means that the longer you had used the phone, the higher your risk. And this was to a 99.9% confidence level. In May of 2014, a French team reported among heavy cell phone users, which they defined as greater than 896 hours of cumulative use, after more than five years, a 430% increased risk of brain cancer. And then in October of 2014, a Swedish team reported a 200% increase of brain cancer for greater than 25 years of wireless phone use. And wireless phone use includes cordless phone use. In May 2013, a UK study reported a 146% increase of acoustic neuroma, that's a hearing nerve tumor, after 10 or more years of use. And they also reported, and this is very interesting to me, that the tumor size increased with increasing use. So that for every 100 cumulative hours, the tumor size increased by 10.3%. And that was followed by a Korean study just a week later that also showed an 8.8% increase tumor size with greater than 2,000 cumulative hours compared to less than 2,000 cumulative hours. Dr. Deborah Davis is going to present information on the dangers to children, especially infants. Professor Paul will present information on how electromagnetic radiation opens up voltage-gated calcium channels in cells, resulting in a cascade of problems at the cellular level. And Dr. Sehan's presentation will provide risk of mechanism of action and the inadequacy of the IARC warnings on electricity, which is called extremely low frequency, ELF, fields, and radio frequency radiation. So now we'll have Deborah Davis.
Thank you, Lloyd. Ellie, can you Skype Deborah to call in? She just called us, but she must have called on the wrong.
Just call Skype.
Hold on a second.
Okay.
I know, but that might be the number that she just called in on, which might not have been her Skype.
Okay, can I hang? Sorry. This one.
That's the video call. Yeah.
That's
okay.
It.
No, that's not it.
Oh, what happened?
That's not it. No. Here, let me just. Sorry, that's not it. Can somebody call? Can you Skype her?
Yeah.
Okay, so we had her in here. Let me go to.
I would just push this video image. That's what I do when I want to Skype with her.
I'm sorry?
Push on.
Yeah,
the,
but it doesn't work.
No. On this. The camera one. Camera picture.
That's what he just did.
Okay. I don't know.
Click on the phone.
Yeah. Please. Click.
No. Are you trying to call?
Okay,
are
good.
Are you trying to call whoever's cell phone? Ellie? Oh, there we are.
Deborah?
Yes, hello.
Okay, welcome to the program. We've had a terrific first panel, and you're the first person on the second panel, and welcome.
Fine. Thank you, and thank you very much for organizing this.
I'm going to do this just a second, Deborah. We're trying to get you full screen.
You don't need me full screen because basically you just want to show the slides, right?
Okay, that's fine. We can just do it that way, and I'll click through the slides for you.
Thank you. Okay, so the first slide we have obviously been dispensed with. I want to just tell you again that what we're trying to do here is so important in terms of giving the public information. And so what you go to the second slide and you will click through and you will find that currently...
Just a second, Deborah. Hold on a minute. We're trying to get it full screen.
The slide?
Just a minute. We're trying to get it so it's full screen.
Right here.
This one?
No, to the right. Yeah, slides are. There you go.
Okay. Go ahead, Deborah.
All right. If you click on the second slide, you will see a series of toys that are being used now that I think is a form of child abuse because they are using iPads for infants in the baby bouncy chair. Are you able to see that now, Camilla?
Yes.
And then the iPoddy and then the iPad teething rattle case. And then if you click one more time, you get to see what children do with phones, which is put them in their mouths. Now, this is not a good idea for a lot of reasons, including the fact that you've already discussed that this is a possible human carcinogen. And my colleagues and I have concluded that it is a probable human carcinogen. The next slide is a video. If you are connected to the internet, you will be able to play it. Are you connected?
No, I don't think we can play it, Deborah.
Then we'll have to pass it. Go to the next one on the electromagnetic spectrum and click. Several clicks and you will see the nature of the spectrum we're concerned about. And the final click will explain. We are concerned about the microwave part of the spectrum. This is not a technical term. It includes microwave ovens, cell phones, cordless phones, baby monitors, and Wi-Fi. The thing about them that's important is not their power, but their pulse. And it's the pulse nature of the radiation we're particularly concerned about. The next slide gives you the visualization of what that looks like. And you can see the source emitting irregular signals with frequency and wavelength. The information content on those signals may be most biologically important. The next slide, if you click through quickly, you will see the change in power density in a 4-second phone call. This repeated change over time is what we think is biologically most important because the human body is meant to adapt to very regular and constant things, and a sudden change for a short period of time, repeated, can be biologically damaging. And this, over just 4 seconds, you see this huge swing up and down. The worst time to put a phone next to your head is when you first answer it, because it goes to max power. or if you're in a car, moving from one cell area to another, it will go to max power. So we go now to the next slide, and I think it's important to realize, from a business point of view, Lloyd's of London does not insure against health damages and has not insured against them since 1997. Swiss Re rates electromagnetic fields as one of the top six business risks in the world today. I think it's very important to be aware that the business community, the insurance industry, is clearly saying that there is a risk here. This is the same category once occupied by asbestos. Now, I'm going to skip the one about why children absorb more microwave radiation than adults, because I'm sure Lloyd will be able to talk to you about it. So let's go to the next one on the pregnant abdomen. Are you with me there?
Yes.
See this modeling that was done through the Swiss National Institute of Technology. The yellow and white is the hottest part of exposure. When at the end of pregnancy, the fetus is most exposed to the spine and the head. And this exposure is quite worrisome. According to studies that you will hear about, you're very fortunate to have there Nesrin Sahan and Suleiman Kaplan. They have done very important work showing the effects on pregnant animals and their offspring from this radiation. And this is why we have launched the Baby Safe Project, urging that women be advised to not have their abdomens exposed directly to cell phone radiation. Wi-Fi not only does damage to the pregnant abdomen, but can also damage sperm. And this is just one study done with a laptop over petri dishes of human sperm. Adjusting for temperature, this study showed twice as much DNA damage in the sperm that were exposed to Wi-Fi. The next slide. We're very concerned, as are scientists in Korea, about what all of this means for our children. And in Korea, they are diagnosing digital dementia. And you see here a statement from Dr. Byung Ji Won in Seoul, Korea, who says that these people who start out at age 3 or 4 using these devices will have a developed left hemisphere, but an underdeveloped right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is the part of the brain that we use for empathy, for impulse control. Think about the consequences of having a generation that lacks empathy and impulse control. The Korean government recently reported on what they call smartphone addiction, and these are data from the Ministry of Science of the government of Korea. And they show a very high rate of addiction among youth, and also a very worrisome increase in the number of people diagnosed with dementia under the age of 65. Finally, I leave you with this website that we've developed now, showthefineprint.org. That website has all of the warnings that are buried inside phones today. This is why it's so important to support the right to know. Why should people have to look at our website to get this information? Why shouldn't it become available immediately before people decide to make purchases? So again, we want women not to use phones near their abdomens, and that is a program we're developing with Yale University's chairman of obstetrics and gynecology, Hugh Taylor. You can click to the next slide and you'll see a picture of what we advise against. And then there are some materials from the Baby Safe Project. Protect your baby from unnecessary exposures. And we think it's very important, and we're very happy to work with people around the world now who are promoting awareness of how to reduce your exposure and why to reduce your exposure. That concludes my presentation.
Okay, so the next speaker is Dr. Martin Paul, and let's just call
up. And while she's setting this up, I want to point out the first time I saw an iPad ad, there was a gigantic billboard as she turned south in downtown San Francisco. Just a woman on her back using her extended belly as a place to put the tablet, and the message was the smile on her face.
Does anybody know the PC? How do you get the slideshow going in a PC?
Oh, here.
The slideshow.
Just go to that little image there, the screen
right,
image.
The little image you said.
Yeah.
This one?
Yeah.
Slideshow. Good. There we go.
There you go.
I will. Don't worry.
Right here. Oh.
She is. Deborah, do you want to stay on Skype?
I can stay on for a moment. I'm going to have to get off in about 15, but I want it while you have this downtime.
All right, we'll have her stay on until she comes
up. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm amazed by the previous presentations, all of them. This is a wonderful setup. Okay, I'm going to talk about electromagnetic fields and how they act via activation of what are called voltage-gated calcium channels and how this then leads to diverse impacts on health. So there's been a great puzzle, which some people have already responded to, and that is that these EMFs are composed of low-energy photons. We're talking about microwave and lower-energy lower frequency fields, they're all made up of very low energy photons. So the photons do not have enough energy to influence the chemistry of our bodies. So then the question is, how can they influence our biology through non-thermal effects? And the safety standards assume that they cannot, that there are only thermal effects need be considered. And if there are no thermal effects, then there cannot be biological effects. And yet there are thousands of papers, as has already been mentioned, in the scientific literature reporting biological effects at exposures well within safety standards. So none of those effects should be there. None of those studies should have been published. The solution to this problem was based on the fact that in 26 different studies, it was shown that various kinds of effects of microwave and also extremely low frequency fields and could be blocked by using calcium channel blockers. These are drugs that are specific for blocking voltage-gated calcium channels, which we abbreviate VGCCs. And when the VGCCs are activated, what happens is they open up a channel, and calcium flows into the cell. And it's the excess calcium in the cell that's responsible for most, if not all, of the biological responses. So, and this was published originally in this paper that's listed here. There's a whole series of other kinds of evidence that also supports this mechanism. And those include close to 1,000 studies published reporting changes in calcium fluxes and calcium signaling that each can be explained as being consequence of VGCC activation. And those are all, those 1,000 studies are all in response to microwave exposures. There are increases in intracellular calcium, which have been shown to, in some cases, to occur almost instantaneously following EMF exposures, which argues that the fields are acting directly on the VGCCs to activate them. When several properties were studied with calcium channel blockers, each of them were blocked, which argues that there are widespread effects that are going through the VGCCs. So it's not just a few things that are happening. There are lots of things that are happening through that mechanism. And each of the VGCCs has a voltage sensor, which is designed to detect electrical effects. And what I showed in a paper that just came out 6 weeks ago is that the properties of that voltage sensor predicts that it is extremely sensitive to activation, to being directly activated by these low-intensity EMFs. So we think that these are direct effects on the voltage sensor activating the VGCCs. As far as I can tell, all of the biological effects in humans and other mammals that have been reported can be explained through this VGCC mechanism. So I think this is probably, this is certainly the main mechanism, and it may well be the sole mechanism. I'm sorry. Okay. So what we have here, so how does it work? What happens? Okay, so as I said before, when you have the microwave and lower frequency EMFs, they activate the VGCCs. This increases intracellular calcium. That's a Ca2i is intracellular calcium. And one thing that occurs as a consequence of that is there's a big increase in nitric oxide because the enzymes that make, two of the enzymes that make nitric oxide are calcium dependent. And so what you have here then is that is that one thing that happens is that nitric oxide has a signaling pathway, which is shown across the top there, working through cyclic GMP and the G kinase. That produces therapeutic responses. There are real therapeutic effects of these fields, and that's the mechanism that by which they occur. And that's what I argued in my 2013 paper. Arthur Pilla, who's a real expert on that, made a very similar argument in a paper that was published almost exactly the same time. Okay, so now the other thing that happens is that calcium can also increase superoxide, and superoxide and nitric oxide react with each other to form peroxynitrite, ONOO minus, right in the middle there, which is a potent oxidant which breaks down to form free radicals and produce oxidative and nitrosative stress. And all those things can have roles in producing pathophysiological effects, so negative impacts on the body of various sorts. In addition, the intracellular calcium can act through other calcium signaling pathways, and that's what's shown by this arrow coming down from Ca2i, to also produce pathophysiology. Basically, what I'm going to argue, and I don't really have time to show any evidence of this whatsoever, is that all of the pathophysiological effects that we see can be produced by these mechanisms. Okay, so basically, we have a lot of studies that have shown various kinds of pathophysiology. There's very strong scientific evidence. That doesn't mean that there are not spokesmen for corporations that argue against these. None of them can be explained by heating. They can all be explained by VGCC activation and downstream effects. Okay, so what are some of those? Oxidative stress is one of them that goes through peroxynitrite and free radical formation. Breaks, single-stranded and double-stranded breaks in DNA can also be produced by free radical attack. And there are other also what are called genotoxic effects, changes in the DNA that can also be produced by these free radical attacks on the DNA. And we think that those are all involved in cancer, and there also may be some other mechanisms that are involved in cancer. So cancer, let me say, I argue, is probably caused by the same mechanisms that we know cause cancer in inflammatory carcinogenesis, which are the ones which I have listed here in the table. Okay, so I think that cancer in response to these fields is very similar to inflammatory carcinogenesis. You get breakdown of the blood-brain barrier also by mechanisms that I've discussed. Male and female infertility. Male infertility has been particularly widely studied, and it's already been discussed by a number of people. This is a very serious problem. Therapeutic effects we've already talked about. Depression and diverse neuropsychiatric effects. This is something that is truly extraordinary, has been mentioned already by several people, and I think is a major threat to human populations all over the world. Melatonin depletion, sleep disruption is another thing that's been widely reported. Cataract formation has been claimed to be due to heating. In fact, it's not due to heating. It's due to VGCC activation. And then there are cardiac effects. You get tachycardia. You can always get bradycardia. So both fast and slow heartbeat. You get arrhythmias. These can, in turn, can lead to sudden cardiac death. These kinds of cardiac changes have been reported in quite a number of studies now in response to these fields. So all of these things, as I say, can be explained through this pathway that we've just discussed. And so as far as I can tell, all the effects are caused by VGCC activation. I don't see any evidence for effects from other pathways in humans and other mammals. I'm not saying there may not be some in some other species. Now, these are not the only pathophysiological effects of EMS, but they're among the best understood. And you can see from the things we've already talked about that they document how microwave frequency EMFs attack each of the four things that we most value as individuals and as a species. One is our health, our brain function, the integrity of our genomes, and the ability to produce healthy offspring. All those things are being attacked. Now, you look at that and you say, well, it's pretty bad. Yeah. It actually, when you look at some of the details, it actually gets still worse. Okay. Believe it or not. Okay. So let's look at a few of those details. And Okay, so I've got some worst case scenarios here. Okay, and I talked about autism, which has been discussed by two of the previous speakers at the Autism One meeting about 6 weeks ago in Chicago, and discussed the fact that there is a lot of evidence that the autism epidemic is caused largely but not completely by EMF exposures. I think there are also chemical effects. This is a figure that I used in that talk. And when you look at the sequence that's on the left side of this slide, you've got microwave lower frequency EMFs acting through the VGCCs to produce increases in intracellular calcium. And those in turn, the intracellular calcium directly affects the formation of the synapses in the developing brain in four ways, each of which are known to be defective in autism. So we think that autism, that the main symptoms of autism occur through this pathway. Chemicals can also come in and affect this. I'm not arguing that chemicals are not involved. I do think that it is probable that microwaves are the primary cause of the autism epidemic. Worst case scenario number two, neuropsychiatric effects. This has been discussed by a number of people. These are effects that have been reported in many different studies, and I've numbered them here, this is out of some 22 studies, I think. You get sleep disturbance, insomnia, headache, depression, fatigue. You get changes in sensory function. You get changes, disruption of concentration, attention, cognitive dysfunction, memory changes, dizziness, irritability, appetite, restlessness, tension, anxiety. All these things have been reported over and over and over again. All of these things are epidemic. And you talk to psychiatrists and psychologists, and quite a number of these have already been discussed at this meeting. Now, you think about a situation where vast numbers of people in a society are impacted by all these things. What does that do to us? There is one other thing that's been reported, and that's been discussed by two people, and that is loss of empathy. If we have widespread loss of empathy in our populations, we basically are a bunch of sociopaths. What does that do to our society? I mean, what does that do to societies anywhere in the world? So these things are extremely worrying. They are increasing. We have increasing exposures every day, every week, every month, every year, over and over and over again. We don't have any idea where we're going. Okay. Worst case scenario number three, sterility, spontaneous abortion. Reproduction may well go to zero in people who are exposed. We know that male and female infertility are increasing. There's good evidence that spontaneous abortion is increasing. There's been discussion on this in these talks earlier about both of those. There was an interesting study that was published by Magras and Zinos some 18 years ago, who showed that mice who were in an antenna park in two locations, both within current safety standards, at the higher level of exposures, they had two locations. The higher level of exposures, they went sterile in about 2.5 months. In the lower level, it took about 5 months. What's this doing to us? It's absolutely unimaginable. Okay, worst case scenario number four. We know that these fields are genotoxic. They do damage to DNA of cells. We know that the germline cells are heavily impacted, as I've just discussed. There have been three studies done where they've looked at mutation rates in the germline cells. I think they were all done in male rats. They all went up. It's been estimated that you only have to increase our mutation rate to about 2.5 to 3 times what we think of as the normal rate, what used to be the normal rate, and we will become extinct because we'll start accumulating more and more deleterious mutations to the point where we will just die out. How close are we to that? I don't know, but we're probably, with this ever-increasing exposure, it couldn't take very long to go in that direction. We are destroying our biological inheritance. Absolutely stunning. Am I 1 minute?
Yeah, 1 minute.
Okay, good. Another worst-case scenario is premature Alzheimer's, and I really don't have time to talk about it, but basically there are a whole series of things that argue that we have an epidemic of premature Alzheimer's and also other neurodegenerative diseases. There are a number of reasons to think that these are caused by these fields, and there was a fascinating study published by this group, Zhang et al., in rats, where basically they exposed rats to pulsed microwave fields and young rats, and by the time they were middle-aged rats, they had all the signs of Alzheimer's in a species that's not known to suffer from Alzheimer's. It's absolutely stunning. Okay, so what do we need to do? Stop increasing levels of exposure. That's the first thing to do. I mean, there are many things, as others have said, there are many things we can do to make these devices much safer, but we are running as fast as we can in exactly the wrong direction. Number two, for reasons that have already been discussed, we need biologically relevant safety standards. And the best way to do that, in my judgment, is to look at the effects of EMFs on cells in culture that have high levels of various kinds of VGCCs. It is easy to do this kind of cell culture work, and I have to say, in this area of the country, in the Bay Area, we have all kinds of people who have great expertise in the area that are needed to do exactly these studies. We need real measurements of biological effects. This is the easiest way to do this. Thank you very much.
A distinguished professor from
Turkey. I'm going to talk on what is the latest EMF science telling us about the risk, the mechanism of action, and the adequacy of the IAC warning. I'm starting with a picture from my university. It is known as Gazi University, a medical faculty, biophysics department. Gazi Biophysics is located in Ankara, the capital of Turkey, and has been carrying out studies on biological impacts of static ELF and RF microwave EMF since 1989. Our laboratory includes physicists, biologists, electrical engineers, and our research team includes engineers, physicians, biochemists, pathologists, and veterinarians. We have been academic representative to NATO Science and Technology Organization since 2007, and I am a WHO International Advisory Committee member on electromagnetic fields since 2001. We do expose animals and cell cultures to radio frequency EMF, including mobile phones. And we do clinical research. And we have been using 900, 1800, and 2100 megahertz in those exposures. We also measure all kinds of EMF sources, including cellular mobile phones, base stations, transformers, Wi-Fis, MRIs, under Gazi Nanoionizing Radiation Protection Center, which I have founded in 2005. As you all know, International Agency for Cancer Research declared that both ELF and RF as possibly carcinogenic to humans. Since 1989, our laboratory performed 22 RF research study and 40 ELF extremely low frequency research study. Some of the studies on cell phone radiation we have done by now, I can list pregnancy study, which some of the results I'm going to share with you today, and clinical and experimental studies of DNA damage, We found hormone hair root cells, DNA breakage in this study, thyroid study, endocrine study, breast fibroblast cell and breast cancer cell study, and many others, BBB study, blood-brain barrier study, epilepsy study, and simulation studies we have done by now. We will discuss some of the results of the cell phone radiation impacts on non-pregnant, pregnant rabbits with their offsprings now. In this study, we used 126 adult, pregnant, and offspring rabbits. And they are all exposed to 1800 megahertz GSM modulated RF microwave for 7 days with the daily exposure of 15 minutes. Here are the exposure groups. This study started in 2006, and we are still going on analyzing the results. We exposed pregnant, 2-day-old infants, 1-month-old female and male infants. And we use the control groups by those alone. Pregnant and adults exposed to 1800 megahertz for 7 days and 15 minutes per day exposure. And after birth, their newborns and 1-month-old male and female infants decapitated to observe possible intrauterine effects of RF. And after birth, some of the female and male infants were nursed by their mothers until they become 1 month and then exposed to 1 week more and decapitated. So the animals are positioned under a horn antenna you see here with a 20 centimeter distance. And SAR is calculated for 1 month old infants as 18 milliwatt per kilogram. Here are the analyzed parameters. We analyze oxidative damage in brain and liver tissues. We analyze DNA base modification in, again, brain and liver tissues. And we did some histopathological and immunohistochemical analysis, and which I'm going to share only these results with you in the brain and eye tissues. So for the results we got for the newborns are intrauterine exposed newborns, and we found for them degenerative changes in cornea, apoptotic changes in neurons and glial cells, and we observed injuries in the brain and eye tissues. As you all know, the most common brain cancers occur in the glial cells, known as gliomas. For the 1 month-old infants, which are exposed intrauterine, we found necrobiotic changes in neurons. Remember, we found degenerative apoptotic changes in neurons for the newborns, but this time, when they become 1 month, we found necrobiotic changes. This means apoptosis turned to necrobiosis when we wait 1 month. And we also find ödem in cornea and apoptotic changes. Please keep in mind that lifetime of a rabbit is 7 to 20 years. So let me remind what is apoptosis and necrosis. In the apoptotic cells, normal cells turn to breaks apart into several apoptotic bodies, and they are phagocytized. There is no inflammation there. But in the necrosis, cell swells and plasma membrane rupture happens. Cellular and nuclear lysis causes inflammation. So in 1 month old rabbits, we observe necrosis, but in the newborns, we only observed apoptosis. Here are some of the here are the pictures related with newborns. The first and second picture shows, first one is ödem in cornea, and second picture showing apoptotic changes in neurons. This picture is showing 1 month-old infants, which is also exposed intrauterine, and you will see the necrobiotic changes in neurons. That means death of a cell. This picture showing oedema in cornea and degenerative change in lens, epithelial lens, for the exposed 1 month-old infants again. The same picture, the same. And the last picture, I think, this is the first picture is changing, showing apoptotic change in the cornea of the 1 month-old infants. The second, very nice picture, the brown-colored area is showing us the retina nerve cells, apoptotic changes in retina cells, nerve cells. So as a result, according to our research findings of pregnancy study, I'm saying that general public's RF exposure limits must take into account pregnancy, the fetus, children, and the elderly, as they are all more vulnerable to the absorption of electromagnetic radiation. And here are some of the resolutions I take part and signed. They started in 2006 with Benevento Resolution, maybe you heard about, and goes on in 2007 with the Venice Resolution, Porto Alegre, Potenza Picana, and the last month, you all know, International EMF Scientists Appeal Resolution, I take part and sign. This list giving you the 10 published articles. These are all published after our pregnancy study. My department's articles on pregnancy study, you can find them from the internet. And here are some of my teams, the ones that is shown with the arrows are the ones that the pregnancy study, that performed this pregnancy study, others doing other studies. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you for your attention.
Just to quickly point out, her pregnancy studies were done at 90 times below the existing exposure limits. 90 times lower exposure than the exposure limits for these pregnant rabbits. 90.
So that's the first two panels. This is a first. We're actually running ahead of schedule, which is just great. So we'll have more time for the Q&A. So we'll take a break right now. We should be back here in 15 minutes. So that's 33 after the hour. And meantime, we're going to... And if you have cards, questions, put them on the cards and send them on up. Thank you. Now we've got to figure out how to get Beatrice in here. Really? with us. We're getting people to take their seats. Come and do the introducing, right? Haley, can you hear me? Can you speak? Okay, so you're going to do the introduction and then we'll hopefully...
Are we ready?
Okay. Gollum's slides, I hope, and supposedly she's going to be able to speak through this.
We did that with Hugh Taylor.
No, but they said you don't even need to hold it up there.
Really?
It's plugged into this. Yeah, that's what she said.
Everybody back in here and ready to hear more wonderful scientists? Can we have your attention, please? Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Ellie Marks. I'm director of the California Brain Tumor Association. And I can't tell you how pleased I am to be here today with the esteemed scientists that we have and doctors that are presenting on this issue, which is very dear to my heart. For personal reasons, my husband, Alan, was diagnosed with a brain tumor in 2008. Thankfully, he is still alive and he's doing quite well. However, many others who have brain tumors that have been attributed to their cell phone use, as my husband's was, as a real estate broker for many years using his cell phone often, are not with us any longer. Developing awareness of the seriousness of this issue through our personal experience has made us both advocates for change. And it's especially a travesty that society is ignorant of the cell phone and wireless risks to fetuses, children, teens, and that's why we are here today. Children are the future, and it is essential that the independent science be shared with parents, schools. Let me turn. We have my phone on because we're going to have a presentation. I'm getting another call. I apologize. We need to share this information with parents, schools, doctors, and governments. And people and communities need to take steps to protect our most valuable resource of all, our children and our grandchildren. The next panel features Dr. Beatrice Gollum, professor of medicine at UC San Diego, who will discuss results of a survey that characterizes electrohypersensitivity. compares risk factors to those of unaffected controls, and presents preliminary data on genetics. And this is also a topic that, unfortunately, I'm familiar with, as I developed electrohypersensitivity. And I realized it. We used to live in Lafayette, and my neighbor's smart meter was about four feet from our master bedroom, and I started becoming ill. And then we also have a second home down in the desert, and we had high levels of dirty electricity. So fortunately, I was in the know, though. And had I not been involved in this work, and I would still be suffering and running from doctor to doctor telling me it's stress-related, take a Xanax. But fortunately, since filtering our home and moving from Lafayette and getting away from the smart meter that she refused to remove, my problems have subsided. But I'm so upset for so many people who are not in the know, and that's why it's so wonderful to hear all these people today, and I hope that many of you will share this with other people and other groups, because a lot of people don't know that some of the problems they're having with their children or with their own health are due to radiation, wireless radiation. And this will only change with the work of the excellent scientists such as those that are with us here today. You will also hear from Dr. Suleiman Kaplan, who's on the Faculty of Medicine and Vice Rector at Andıkuş Mayıs, did I get that right? University in Samsun, Turkey. He will present some very important science on the effects of pre- and postnatal mobile phone radiation on the hippocampus. And finally, Dr. Mary Redmain from Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, will bring us back to the subject of what is happening to children and teens with an overview of international actions being taken to protect children, the subject of a paper about to be published on this topic presently in press. So without further ado, are we going to go with Dr.
Gullum?
We will now hear from Dr. Gullum from UC San Diego, who's going to participate by my cell phone.
Okay.
I never hold it to my head or body.
Dr. Gullum, are you there? Hello? Valerie, in the back? Is it plugged?
Mm-hmm. But she's not. She needs to call in.
Why don't you call her?
Okay. We can do that.
I already know the extension by heart. Hi, Haley, we're ready.
Okay, should I just transfer her line?
Sure.
Line? Sure.
Number? Okay.
Sure. Yeah?
Yeah, you can transfer it.
Thank
okay,
you.
Perfect.
Okay, Dr. Gullum?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Welcome, and we're so glad we got the technical issues figured out. You're on.
Okay, great. And so everybody else, I haven't been able to hear any of the previous talks, so if any of this seems not to make sense or to be duplicative, I apologize. What? Okay, just a minute here. Let's see if we can get this working a little bit better. I thought it was going to go through the sound system. Valerie? Just a minute, please. So will it make any difference if I put this into the microphone?
Do you need me to talk to see if you can hear things?
Just a minute, Ellie, is your phone on the highest volume? Okay, so can you talk again, Dr. Gullum? Let's just make sure we can hear you.
ZYXWVUTSRTPONMLKJIHGFEDCBA.
Did you understand that?
Slower.
Slower.
Okay, ZYXWVUTSRQPONMLKJIHGFD.
Can everybody hear me? Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. All right. Electromagnetic radiation, throughout the range that has been linked to reported health problems, has been shown to cause oxidative stress injury. From the bottom row with power lines at 60 hertz to the top row with radar in the range of 12 to 18 gigahertz, studies have shown depressions by electromagnetic radiation at melatonin levels, and melatonin is a critical antioxidant, as well as increases in oxidative stress. Next slide. Our lab has an interest in conditions tied to oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction, and the goals of this study are to first characterize electrohypersensitivity, or EHS, including demographics, risk factors, triggers, symptoms, and impacts, and to compare oxidative stress-related risk factors in people who have electrohypersensitivity relative to controls, to assess symptom compatibility with oxidative stress, and to secure pilot data on genetics of oxidative stress detoxification. Next slide. The study uses a case series and case control design. Participants are a convenient sample. Did you say something?
No.
Okay. Participants are a convenient sample of electrohypersensitive cases and unaffected controls selected for participation. In the interest of time, I will omit the remainder of the methods that can answer questions. Next slide. Participants included about 200 people who report currently electrohypersensitive, that left column of EHS now, about 50 participants who report having been electrohypersensitive, and then two other that we won't consider in this talk, a small number who report formerly hypersensitive, and an other category, which is primarily people who aren't sure whether their symptoms relate to electromagnetic radiation. Next slide. Participant characteristics are shown here. Average age of both cases and controls was around first. On the far right is the p-value, which is the probability that it is between cases and controls by chance alone, and by convention, a p-value less than 0.05 or 1 in 20 considered statistically significant. We see that most of were Caucasian and college graduates, consistent with the character of people's sense of self-participation in research studies, but that it are more females among sensitive than among controls. That was statistically significant here. Because this isn't a stratified random sample, this could relate to how people self but in fact, this is consistent with other evidence that suggests females are at higher risk for hypersensitivity. Next slide. We asked people at the time of onset of their first that they now attribute to electromagnetic radiation, were they aware that they had solar problems? The vast majority, 72%, said no, they were not. Even among those who were aware that others had reported similar problems with electromagnetic radiation, some expressed that they had been skeptical. Quote, I knew someone who claimed to be sensitive to EMR, but I thought she was nuts. Quote, but I had always thought they were just being overly concerned until I experienced it for myself. Or quote, but I did not believe that it was built, thought it was sick. Next slide. We also asked, at the time they first attributed their symptoms to electromagnetic radiation, that is to say, when they first developed the symptoms, but first connected them to EMR, were they aware that others had similar problems with EMR? The fraction who said yes was considerably higher, a little over half, but it remained the case that 44% of people, even at the time connected their symptoms EMR exposure, were unaware that others had symptoms associated with EMR. This slide looks at risk factors with a known relationship to oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction, particularly any of us called overlap conditions, including multiple sensitivity, MS, fatigue syndrome, irritable bowel syndrome, or fibromyalgia. And we see that for each of these conditions, rates are markedly higher in cases than in controls, and differences are highly significant. I've also reviewed the evidence that these conditions have a well-documented connection both to oxidative stress and to mitochondrial dysfunction. Next slide, please. This slide shows additional risk factors of known connection to oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction. Fluoroquinolone use, equivalent to a class impact that caused 3 oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction, higher among cases among control. Among those who had used fluoroquinolone, presence of a fluoroquinolone adverse effect been shown again to be mediated by oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction was higher in cases than in controls. In controls who took fluoroquinolone is smaller, so this is just marginally significant. There were a higher fraction who reported any toxicity in cases in controls, a higher fraction who reported having an autoimmune condition, and a higher fraction who reported a first-degree relative with chemical intolerance or with an autoimmune condition. Multiple studies show that oxidative stress is tied to development of autoimmune conditions because oxidative stress modifies proteins, A, RNA, and lipids in a fashion that makes them vulnerable to autoimmune attacks. Sorry, next slide. We also inquired about a history of electrocution, obviously not in a sense being fatal electrocution, and 22% of electrosensitive cases compared to fewer than 5% of controls reported a history of an electrocution event, a difference that was highly significant. Comments included among cases struck by lightning strike age 18, high voltage work accident, near fatal accident with DC current, etc. This can be interpreted any of several ways. It's conceivable there could be caller reporting hypersensitivity. I think this is unlikely because knowledge has been little or no attention of a connection between prior electrocution and current electrosensitivity. It's also possible that this could be due to electrocution predisposing toward becoming hypersensitive. In fact, this was the reason for which we asked the question. Many people with electrohypersensitivity, a more significant exposure that to to their problem, and then sometimes report steps associated with subsequent considerable exposures, consider the possibility that past exposures before the onset of electrohypersensitivity may have stopped cellular injury that might have predisposed them. A couple of other possibilities, one being, for example, that a common factor may predispose electrocution to electrohypersensitivity, such as elevated metal levels in the body. Slide, please. We asked participants who had EHS whether there was a triggering event, and about 70% said was a triggering event that seemed to precipitate the onset of electrosensitivity. By overwhelmingly, the most significant triggering event was first, and the most common triggering events other than combinations combined other were their cell phones. Smart meters were over, well, approximately threefold more commonly reported as a triggering any other individual exposure class. Next slide. We inquired about symptoms attributed to electromagnetic radiation. It shows some of the most common order of us. What is remarkable about this is high relative homogeneity among the most commonly reported symptoms. 80% of participants have problems and cognitive problems and heart rhythm problems and sleep problems. These sleep problems were almost reported. Next slide. Slide shows that each has a known literature relationship to oxidative stress, and only one citation is included for each citation in each of these symptoms to oxidative stress. Next slide. We inquired of those asked what the responsible medical provider was to their electrohypersensitivity, separating out providers in blue from traditional providers in red. As you can see on the left, the majority of alternative providers were characterized helpful compared to the minority of traditional providers. And whereas very few alternative providers approaching 40% of traditional providers were characterized. This difference between alternative and traditional providers was highly statistically significant, less than one chance in 10 million by chance alone. Next slide, please. We asked participants the impact on a scale of zero, no impact worst possible, across a range of domains affecting their lives, including the overall impact on their life on the far left, effect on them personally, and their living situation, which we shortened for on the file for the chart, etc. And we see on the far right that the least affected of these religion, in part because the number of participants reported they had no religious involvement before their electrohypersensitivity. The second least affected was civic involvement, in part, again, because some people had no civic involvement, and other people actually reported increasing their civic involvement because of their electrohypersensitivity. But for the remainder of these domains, marked and highly profound reported on multiple different domains of life, and to adequately characterize it, it's really the participant's comments that create the emotional feel for how impact is, but in the interest of time, we're not able to provide those. Next slide, please. This looks more close to professional impact, and after excluding the 18% of participants who report that they were retired at the time they developed electrohypersensitivity, that there could be no professional impact, a fraction who reported a range of different professional impacts, and we see that approximately 45% of those who were working at the time of development of their electrohypersensitivity reported having actually lost a job because of. Others reported having to avoid meetings or telecommute, reported reduced performance, loss of clients, or use of old technology. Slide, please. This slide looks at overall financial impact, including loss of income as well as expenses linked to their electrohypersensitivity. Many people reported comparatively mild financial impact, less than $10,000. There were a non-trivial number of people who reported quite significant financial impact, in the range of $100,000 to $1 million, even more. Next slide, please. Also, preliminarily at genetics associated with oxidative stress detoxification, this shows for cases only. The intent is to have one-to-one matching on age, sex, and ethnicity of control cases, and we stop a few of the control samples yet, but they necessarily lag the cases. And until we get a larger number of those cases and controls, comparing them won't be possible. But this does provide interesting information. C-orthomethyltransferase adverse polymorphisms, or ACEs, were present in 82% of electrosensitive participants. Catechol orthomethyltransferase adverse polymorphisms are actually linked to higher fluid intelligence, more vulnerability to oxidative stress injury. And part of this is because these adverse polymorphisms reduce the catecholamines like epinephrine, that is to say adrenaline, and catecholamines in turn affect the blood volume, amplifies the energetic damage of oxidative stress to tissue. Oxidative stress adversely affects cell energy both by causing dysfunction of mitochondria and by causing what's called endothelial dysfunction, which means that the line the muscles fail to open up in response to energy needs. Also, over 3/4 of participants had adverse polymorphisms in superoxide dismutase 2. This is the mitochondrial superoxide dismutase, a critically important oxidant that reverts damage to oxidative stress to mitochondria. This is particularly important for oxidative injury to mitochondria, including mitochondrial DNA, both to ongoing and potentially permanent decrements in cell energy, but also leads to ongoing increase in production of oxygen both, that is oxidative stress. This is because mitochondria are the leading source, particularly when injured, of free radicals intracellularly, as well as the leading target of them. And also of great interest are slow leader adverse polymorphism transferase. That's rows 3 and 4. These adverse polymorphisms are slow accelerator polymorphisms, and 100% of electrosensitive cases looked at far, and this will obviously change as the sample gets bigger, had one of these two adverse polymorphisms. Now, acetyltransferase is actually the rate-limiting enzyme in production of melatonin, and melatonin has been shown in multiple studies to protect against electromagnetic field damage by both antioxidant and other mechanisms. So this sets up a situation in which electromagnetic radiation depresses levels of melatonin, which in turn amplify vulnerability to electromagnetic radiation, and this is expected to be greater in people who have less ability to recover reduced melatonin, such as people with these adverse NAT polymorphs. And in interest of time, I will skip the remainder of the next slide. So overall, the findings show that electrohypersensitive symptoms with known biology. Profile of symptoms, by and large, is shared with other conditions with known link to oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction, heavily including among fatigue, cognition, muscle, GI, autonomic, with other symptoms represented as well. Two differences are, first, that sleep symptoms are unusually prevalent in electrohypersensitivity, but that makes sense given known effects of electromagnetic radiation in many studies on levels of melatonin. And also, ear symptoms are unusually prevalent in electrohypersensitivity compared to these other conditions, with ear symptoms including otalgia, meaning ear pain, tinnitus, and hearing loss. Also, compatible biology for this. Damage to the ear has been affirmed in the literature. For example, quote, a permanent side effect of EMF with severe cochlear damage and permanent sensory neural hearing loss in experimental animals, and another study showing that 60 minutes of close exposure to EMF from a mobile phone, quote, had an immediate effect on hearing threshold limits assessed by pure tone audiogram and inner ear in young human subjects. Next slide. So this study has limitations. It's a convenient sample, which means we can't calculate rates, but we don't report to. Information is provided by self-report, but those affected are the best source of information on EHS, natural history, symptoms, and impact. There's a focus on oxidative stress, but in no way precludes the relation of EHS to other biological mechanisms. But a key strength of this study, or at least this study going forward, is that participants declare their EHS without knowing their genetics, and there's no known mechanism to manipulate genetics by such factors as suggestibility, psychosomatics, etc. If a relation of specification and EHS is found, this will provide powerful presumptive evidence of a link of oxidative stress to EHS. And in fact, of course, there are already other evidence. In summary, next slide, most deaths were unaware that others had electromagnetic radiation associated symptoms at the time their symptoms emerged. And although I wasn't able to cover this, inference links to EMR were largely based on these challenge, we challenge effects, which is exactly the kind of evidence that is typically used to determine the likely cause for drug adverse effects. Second, evidence for biological mechanisms through oxidative stress. EMR is known to produce oxidative stress. Oxidative stress-linked conditions are risk factors for EHS. Reported in EHS have a known link to oxidative stress. Preliminary genetic are intriguing and potentially consistent with an oxidative stress explanation, but require more data and full data to conclusions. The effects on people's lives and livelihoods are profound. Next slide. I'm just going to close with a shameless plug. Any of you who haven't done so, whether you are affected or affected, if you complete a survey, this will help us, hopefully to help others. And the link to the survey is listed here. Also, feel free to donate. All of this work has been done on volunteer time. We have a small academic senate grant that only funded the first 15 pairs of genetic data. And if you want to donate to assist, feel free to donate to Becker online or contact us. Thank you so much for your time and attention. And if I can hear, which I think I can, I'd be happy to address any questions. And next and final slide.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, we have the Q&A. We have two more people speaking, and then the Q&A. Would you like to be part of the Q&A in about a half an hour? Actually, it's a little longer than that because we've got the policy discussion. Or does anybody have just a quick question or two for Dr. Gollum right now? No. Oh, well, one. Yes, go ahead.
Does she have a paper out that she can give a reference to? Uh-huh.
Do you have a paper out that you could give a reference to, or can you make it available?
We've just gotten these data in now, so there's their paper out. It's not been submitted yet.
When it is, we'll post it on Electromagnetic Health for sure. Okay, yes, another question.
How does one participate in the study?
Yeah, how does one participate in the study?
If you could go back to the Help This Project shameless plug slide, at the bottom is contact information. At the top is the link to the survey. And participants in the survey part are the group group among which we choose for the genetic part, or anybody who strongly likes the genetic part and is willing to pay the reduced rate for the research rate for the cost, we're happy to include you in that part.
We'll put a post up on electromagnetic health with the link. Okay, great. Thank you so much, Dr. Gollum. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, Ellie, you're next. You're going to introduce. Here we go. Dr. Suleyman Kaplan from Turkey.
Okay, Dr. Suleyman Kaplan is all the way here from Samsung, Turkey, and he is on the Faculty of Medicine and Vice Rector at Andakus Mayıs University, and he is going to present some very important science on the effects of pre- and postnatal mobile phone radiation on the hippocampus. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for invitation. I would like to thanks to Camelia and her colleagues to organize this meeting. I am very happy to be in here the second time in San Francisco. 2013, I have been a week in this nice city. It's a good opportunity to talk about some our previous experimental study. As you listen, many of the clinical and the some other studies, experimental studies, have been done, and then the result of them already shared with you. As you know, as a result of the increasing the technology, developing each technological devices and give a good opportunity to speed our life. And also the increase our quality or life. But the other side, we can see some of the side effect of them. As previous presenter mentioned about all of them. And then the human studies is really, really very difficult because of some ethical issue and also some cost effect. For this reason, we as a scientist, we generally prefer the animal, laboratory animal, to see what happened after some of the exposure of these devices. In our laboratory, we use the laboratory animal and then designed to see after the exposure which type of the change can be seen, especially for the exaggeration and the amplification. We use the prenatal period because of this period is very vulnerable, and then you can see a few of the amount of the side effect of the any substance can be seen easily. For this reason, we prefer the prenatal animal, and then they expose during their gestational period. After the period, we leave them, and then about 4 weeks, like this one, 1 month later, in the postnatal of there, we evaluate it. And also, I will mention about some neuroprotective substance after the exposure. You know, how can we protect our neuron and in the brain and the other region of central nervous system? And also, I will give some information about our human studies already has been done. It's not published yet. I will share this information about human study also with you. You know, the effect of this exposure, electromagnetic exposure, is well known already. And then even the low frequency can affect the brain cells especially and the nervous system cells. We use the 9 megahertz because of we would like to imitate the real cell phone exposure. You know, it's very interesting. and especially if you move from the United States or other countries, developing country, you can see more telephone, and high number of the telephone, and a few number of the toilets. You know, one is the harmful for our body, other is protected our health. And then it's very, very important, especially if you move the African countries, each house have number of the telephone, but neither they have toilets in their houses. Okay, we would like to see the real change after the prenatal exposure. This study was designed and published in the Brain Research, well-known esteemed journal. And then I will show you some figure, you know, the prenatal exposure. After the prenatal exposure, we analyzed by means of these techniques, serological techniques. These techniques give such opportunity to approach the shoe and the organ in three-dimensional. If you use the two-dimensional approach, that means you may miss something. You may, your comment may be incorrect. For this reason, we always use serological techniques to analyze the real number of the cells in each organ and the tissue and the region. After the gestation period of the animal for the rats, it takes about 21 days. We started the first day of the gestation, 1 hour per day. By the end of the gestation period, it means 21 days exposure have been done by 1 hour per day. After that, animal live after the birth delivery, and then animal live to grow and one month old. After the 1 month old, we analyze the brain, especially is related memory and the learning process. It's named the hippocampus, you know. We count the number of the hippocampus in the dentate gyrosus. Some of them you may know. We show that the control group has more cell than the electromagnetic field exposure. You know, this is the real, it's very important. This is this data between the control and the exposure group is significantly different. This is the one of the hippocampal region. It's named the dentate gyrosus. I show you some of the picture taken from the exposed and the non-exposed group. Everybody can easily anticipate which picture is belong to the exposed, which picture is belong to the non-exposed group. It's, you know, you can easily say this is the this picture taken from the control group, because as you know, as you see in here, the neuron in that region, this is the dentate gyrosus of the brain, hippocampal region, and then the cell's shape is looks very healthy. If you move the exposed group, as you see in here, many of the condensed, that means these cells are going to die, and then they will be eliminated in that region later period. And then if you look at the magnificate picture of this region, a very healthy neuron can be seen in that region, but very condensed cells, that means non-functional cells can be seen in that picture. It's, our biological common does not based on these pictures. Our biological common or based on these figures, this number. You know, because of the picture can be changed easily, because of the tissue process, something can affect the quality and the view of the picture. But the figure cannot be changed easily. Okay, this is another study. It's the same process has been done. We use the three groups: exposed, shame, and the non-exposed group. The number of the cells in the hippocampal region, it's named the CA1, corneoamnionis region. This is the CA region, This is the number of the cells. This is the control group. This is the EMF exposure group. As you compare the both number, significant difference between them. Okay? Exposed group, that means during the prenatal exposure, this electromagnetic exposure, radio frequency exposure, destroyed the stem cell in the, that region because cannot because of the cell is increased and produce even the postnatal in the brain. If you lost many of the stem cell in the some of the brain region, and then you cannot produce more cell in that region. I will show you another picture. This is the taken from the control group. This is the shame group. This is the exposed group. If you compare the control and the exposed group, the density of neuron is can be seen easily. You see, you can see a few number of the cell in that region. You can see a lot of cell in that region. This is the control group. This is the exposed group. Exposure decreased the number of cell significantly, especially this is the memory and the learning region. We wonder about if we expose the animal after the expose adult animal. You know, we use the two studies for the prenatal exposure. We wonder what happened after the adult life. We expose the adult female animal to electromagnetic field, and then the design of the study is same as you see in here. The Purkinje cell, this Purkinje cell is located in the cerebellum. This is the organ of belong to the central nervous system. This figure also shows that the exposed group have few cells than the shame and the control group. And the picture of exposed group, you know, the density of the neuron in here, a few neuron can be seen. This is the Purkinje cell. This is the Purkinje cell. As you see, the same magnification has been used, both three of them. And then the decreasing of the cells can be seen in that region if you compare by the non-exposed and the shame group. Okay, we already know EMF exposure decreases the cell number in cerebellum in the hippocampal region. How can we protect this neuron? Because we know some of the protect done, like some of them know. How can we protect this neuron? Our studies based on the protection of the neuron after the exposure, you know. We designed an experiment, as you see in here. We have seven groups, as you shown in here. Pure control, sham, exposed group, exposed plus melatonin group, exposed plus omega-3 group, melatonin only group, and omega-3 only group. You know, by design of this study, we would like to see how can protect melatonin after the exposure, and how can omega-3 protect neuron after the exposure. Our exposure system is like this one, as you see in here. The rat is put inside of these glasses, and then they will stay in here only 1 hour per day. The exposure time for this study is about 78 days. You know, during the 78th day, each animal received 1 hour per day. And then we use the serological techniques to analyze them, as you seen here. Each point of the region have equal opportunity to be sampled. You know, we cannot have a choice to select some of them. All of this region have equal chance to be sampled. This is a very important point. By means of these techniques, you can communicate your tissue. You know, if you do not use the real language, with your corresponding person, and then you cannot receive the enough information. You know, for this reason, we use these techniques. By means of these techniques, we can easily receive the real information about the tissue. As you see here, extended exposure, like 900 megahertz, decreasing the cell number in CA region. This is the memory and the learning related region. And melatonin and omega-3 protect hippocampal cells. It's very impressive. And using omega-3 without exposure decreased the number of cells in prenatal period. This is the figure taken from the our graphics, as you see here. EMF exposed group have less neuron than the control, and then the EMF plus melatonin, EMF plus omega-3, and then as you see here, if you expose the during the prenatal period, omega melatonin substantially increase the number of the cells in that region. Omega-3 is toxic if you use the without exposure. This is the picture taken from the each group, as you see here. This is another region of the hippocampal region. Sorry, this is the same result is seen in here, and the same result is a look than here. If we compare the total number of the cells in that region, the EMF exposure decreased the number of cells, but melatonin and omega-3 protect the neuron in hippocampal region. What is the message of this result? EMF reduced the neuron number in the brain. Melatonin and omega-3 have a neuroprotective effect of its after the exposure. Using melatonin without the exposure has a neuroprotective effect and also increases the neurogenesis. You know, it's very, very important. Using omega-3 without exposure shows side effect on the brain. We don't know what is the main reason of this. I will complete it. Okay. We have some of the human study. We used the female subject, female human. You know, why we prefer the human subject? Because we know that human and woman use the cell phone than the male person. I don't know. Some of them is suggested like this one. And we use the 60 healthy person. We have two groups. One group using the cell phone less than 1 hour. One group using the one and a half hour per day. You know, two groups have, it's very. We use some of the data. This is the MRI image taken from the brain of them. And then if you look at we located the hippocampal region, because this is a very, very important region for the thinking and the memory and the learning process, to see what change can be seen in that place. We estimate the stereological, you know, we use the stereological technique to estimate the volume of them on them. We couldn't find any difference between the less exposed and the long exposed group, you know, as you see here. We also do some cognitive test, you know, cognitive test. If you look at this data, you can see long exposure impair memory, you know, decrease memory. Okay, I will complete it, sorry. And also, we will see some of the substances in the brain, like keratin and N-acetyl aspartate keratin and acetyl aspartate, also we analyze them, but there is no significant difference between them, exposed and less exposed, long exposed duration. The conclusion, there was no significant difference between the groups in terms of the hippocampal volume. Long-term exposure impair memory, and then additional experiment requires needing. What is the home message? EMF exposure should be limited at least during the pregnancy and the postnatal period, developing period. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Mary Redmain, who has published a paper today on an overview of what's happening by different governments around the world to protect children. Mary, Dr. Redmain. We're running about 10 minutes late, so we really have to stick to the schedule because we want to have plenty of time for Q&A.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Camilla, for that the invitation for today and for the introduction. I'm very happy to be here. I've spent the last 7 years full-time involved in research and reading about exposure to radio frequencies, and my particular interest is children. I also would like to acknowledge the Australian National Health and Medical Research Council. I see I need to bring my presentation up, but I'll just finish my...
Okay, you have to escape.
Thank you, yes. I'll finish my acknowledgements. The Medical Research Council and Monash University, where I work. So that has allowed me to be here today. Thank you. Yes, I'm back near the microphone. Thank you. So I'll go back. So we've heard today a little bit about how children have responded to electromagnetic fields, and just the tip of the iceberg of the research of what is being done about exposures to electromagnetic fields. But what is the world doing about it? So I'm going to talk about what's happening in terms of policy around the world. And first of all, why does that matter? Well, as we've heard, there's a huge number of children now using this technology. There's a vastly greater range of the technology, much of it designed specifically for children, and even babies are using it. This infant in the bottom left picture was a child who sat next to me on a plane, and he was completely familiar with selecting a game, scrolling for it, selecting, playing, closing, and choosing another one. I think he was 15 months. I didn't hear him say a word the whole trip to Greece, but he knew how to use this. So all this indicates that there's an increased need for relevant policy and advice relevant to our children. Around the world, many countries, not all of them, have standards or guidelines. The standards are generally legal. The guidelines are recommendations. All of them intend for this to provide safety for our health. But they have a very different definition of what health is. The least stringent approach only considers, as we've heard, the thermal effects, and this means damage, shock, heat or shock damage over the space of 30 minutes. And then that's calculated, and then there's a very large margin put on that for safety. So that's only the short-term concerns. And then you have that's illustrated, the limits that are then allowed are illustrated on the left of this diagram. And on the right is a typical levels allowed at a very precautionary approach. I'll go through each of these stages. So my little cartoon is showing that the approaches are very, very different. If we look at I'll talk you through this, there's a lot in it. In the top row, which is the dark blue, the least stringent approach, which is typical for taken in the US, England, New Zealand, and several other countries, it's based on science, as I've said. It's designed to prevent heat and shock in the short term, half an hour. And the countries that follow this say there's no extra precaution needed, including the US. They say no extra precaution is needed to ensure your child's health. There are a few countries that take this thermal approach that do recommend reducing exposure to children anyway. Australia is one of those. Then there's a precautionary approach. Their basic standard is the same as we have here, but they do recommend reducing children's exposures, and they have an extra precautionary tier to ensure that for places where children spend time. So some of those They vary a lot. Some of them are precautionary for where children are in commercial premises, such as kindergartens, but others will include homes as well. It depends on the country. The other precautionary approach is the top green row, where the standard is to apply to adults and children, and there's a much more stringent standard for everybody. This is the environmental standard, what you're exposed to from base stations, radio, TV, the Wi-Fi routers, other than the ones in your own home that you have some control over. And these countries all advise or give laws on controlling exposure from the devices you use, because pretty much everyone needs to have the same devices that have the levels allowed here. So the way they handle that to reduce personal exposure is to have extra laws or precautionary advice on how to use that equipment. And much of that is aimed at children. And the last one is, again, a scientific approach based on physics and biology intended to prevent short-term thermal effects and to prevent bio effects. So they're concerned about long-term health effects. And it's based on 40 to 50 years of their own research, some of it longitudinal research that's gone over many years. And they've come up with levels which are far more stringent. So the precautionary standard is generally set at about that level, the people who take a precautionary approach. And these countries have advice, laws, and some of them, well, Russia has very strong warnings as well about what to expect if we don't take more precaution. And these are some examples of countries taking each of these approaches. I'll just give you a moment to look rather than reading them because I'm limited in my time. Personal exposures. So we're now looking at what happens with the equipment you use, the baby monitor, as we've heard, the mobile phone, tablet, cordless, and the various devices you wear to measure your heart and goodness knows what else these days. So the exposure is much the same as the ICNIRP or the IEEE, which is the approach taken here, because this is a device. If you, we could reduce those exposures a lot that come out of these devices, but they would work far less well in a lot of places, and people want their equipment to work. So the countries, as I mentioned, dealing with that, impose extra laws or regulations. Here are just some specific laws or policies aimed at minors. In the left-hand column, you'll see the policy advice or law, and in the right-hand column, the country or region or city providing that advice. So I'll just spell out a few of them. Some countries require specific absorption rate labeling. That's the SAR. That's the amount of exposure you're allowed to be involved to. It has to be labeled, and the idea being that what they're proposing, and that is that the lower exposure is better. There's actually, it's not quite that simple, but I'll keep going. There's children's mobile phones designed especially for children, like little cartoon characters, have been banned in some countries. Low emission phones are advised. Some countries are now preferring Wi-Fi, wired over Wi-Fi in schools and in preschools. The number of those is increasing, including France brought this in last year. I shall carry on. And these are specific laws that have been introduced in the last year, most of them this year. So banning Wi-Fi in child spaces, that as far as I can find out so far, there's now three places that have banned it for young children, Ghent, Israel, and France. And then there's rules about wireless access for internet in elementary school must be disabled when not being used for teaching in France, and headsets must be offered if asked for when selling cell phones, that child headsets must be offered if asked for. There's the bill, the C648 bill, which I'll mention in just a moment, which is terrific. And this is a really interesting one. Taiwan this year has banned all use of electronic devices by under two-year-olds. And there's a hefty fine for parents that allow it. Now, I don't know how they're going to police that, but it's quite an interesting policy. the Berkeley citizens' right to know, I regard as a really... This is a really major step. About a year ago, I gave my first talk to do with policy, and at that stage, I identified a gap in the policy, which was that people are not being given any advice anywhere about the use of devices against other parts of the body than the head. So, but we all the time we see people using their tablets, laptops, and phones down here against the abdomen or across the groin. We've got a lot of important organs down there. Children have the growth plate of their thigh there, very busy and active, lots of stem cells, very busy and active. This is a really important area, and these devices, as you see, they're tested maybe at 0 to 20 centimetres, it depends which one you get, and if you read the book, it says for standard operating positions, but they don't say what those positions are, and they may regard it as being here or on a table. Whereas children will use these devices in all sorts of manners that we haven't thought of, probably many different positions. And these are just quite common. This child is quite fixated, very close. The chin is almost against the laptop. And the one on the right, she's got it sitting against her abdomen, upper abdomen. The transmitter is in there. There are people, independent organisations and individual scientists providing advice. If they're in the least stringent camp on the left, then according to that, there's no need to take any further action regarding children. So those uses would be all right. Putting a transmitter in your mouth if you're a baby or anyone else in my book is not all right. And the ones on the right are those advised taking precautionary steps. This is, of course, there are far more people for both lists in this. So the example on the right there, a teenager using a device on a desk, fine, it's at a reasonable distance. This is hopefully a small part of her day. On the right, you've got younger children using books. Yay. So should environmental safety guidelines be strengthened for added protection? The thermally based guidelines used around the world appear to be meeting their goal of preventing acute shock and thermal damage. So those countries recommending that approach, yes, it does that. But it leaves out all that area to do with chronic exposure. It's just not considered at all. And you could say, well, environmental exposures are usually very low, and they are in most places, but they're averaged. And if it's not the average that's causing the problem, but the pulsing or some other aspect, then we've got a problem. And there is evidence showing bioeffects at extremely low levels. So I think that there must be at least one other mechanism, and we've heard of some today, that is responsible. So in my opinion, we need a stringent environmental limit. And should personal safety guidelines be strengthened? This is a tricky one, as I mentioned. If you want your devices to work properly, then it's hard to expect that they can only give out less, especially if it's going to make enough less to make a difference. So really, the best, the most effective, immediate way to address this is to habitually stop or minimise personal exposure, and especially at night time, where it's giving your body a chance to remend, so that if you turn off everything that transmits in your house at night and don't allow any transmitting equipment in children's bedrooms, you do the best you can to minimise your children's exposure. I'd like to demonstrate how to hear radio frequencies, but I see Camilla approaching and think I might have to leave it for question time if someone's interested. So to summarise, the policy and advice around the world varies enormously. Maximum environmental exposures vary 10 to 100 fold. Maximum personal exposures are limited, are similar everywhere, and that accounts for the wide range of advice and laws to address children's exposure, depending on whether the country thinks that there's more effects than thermal or not. So there's no consensus on safety around the world. Parents and teachers are confused, children are caught in the middle, And I recommend that parents and schools minimise children's exposure to RF-EMR as a precautionary step. This paper has actually just been published, not in print anymore, and it's not freely available, so if anyone's interested in getting it, you'll need to email me and I'll send you a copy. Thank you.
Okay, well, we're now in the last stage of today's program. We're going to have Dr. Joel Moskowitz from UC Berkeley give us a few minutes on the policy implications of all of this. And while he's coming up here, I also just want to thank our Kevin Kuntz, who is our videographer today. He's the documentary maker who did the film Mobilize, and if you haven't seen it, please do. And I know I've gotten a lot of questions from you all, and several of you are asking, like, how can you spread this? And so I hope you will spread the video from this that we'll post by next week, but also that movie is an excellent one to show in your communities, hold salons, and I recommend it. Okay, Joel, I got to get you. Just a second.
Good afternoon. I hope you're still awake. I only get 10 minutes, and this is a very complex
we'll make
assignment,
it.
But I will try to hit the high points. And what I don't get to cover, check out my website, saferemr.com, where I discuss many of these issues in more detail. I also have supplemental slides, which you won't see today, which provide more detail on some of the issues that I will cover. It also provides links to key studies. And you heard today many of the most recent studies summarized by some of the leading researchers. You also heard from some of the leading practitioners about the kinds of problems they're encountering and how they're addressing them. I've been working on this issue since 2009 when my colleagues and I at Berkeley and at the National Cancer Center in South Korea published a review of the research showing the links between tumor risk and mobile phone use. And since then, the research has become much more consistent, and I would argue in the last 5 years, the preponderance of the research shows bioeffects and serious health consequences from exposure to wireless radiation. The industry and our government has been arguing that there's no consistent evidence. You've heard several references to the International EMF Scientist Appeal. This is one of the issues I worked on in the past year with several colleagues around the country and in North America. Here's a summary of some of the specific recommendations. There's actually more of them. I have the actual appeal, copies of the appeal with me. So if you want a copy, see me afterwards, and I can give it to you. It's just 2 pages. But you'll notice one of the most important things we're addressing is the need for stronger guidelines. Both radio frequency and extremely low frequency are problematic. It's been recognized as such by the IARC. And the research community, at least several hundred members of the research community, including some people in this room, have basically issued a wake-up call to the world leaders, the United Nations and the WHO, to try to get them to address the latest research in an unbiased fashion. Our government does have a responsibility to ensure public health and safety, but when I started Googling this, it's a lot more complicated than it seems, and I don't really have the time to go into that now, but much of the responsibility actually lies with the states as opposed to the federal government, but in this case, radio frequency radiation, the federal government has preempted the state's rights and locality rights with regard to being able to regulate this risk, environmental risk and consumer product risk. We've seen the precautionary principle earlier today, so I won't go into it other than to say that it resonates better in some countries than others, and ours is not one of those countries where it resonates very strongly with many policymakers. We're not a very prevention-oriented country. We let our bridges decay, for example. We don't put money into infrastructure. Prevention gets a very small part of our healthcare dollar. I could go on and on, but and the precautionary principle doesn't have much resonance in terms of our body of law either, because we demand conclusive evidence typically before making decisions. The elephant in the room is the industry, and the industry is represented by the CTIA, the Wireless Association. I assume there are some representatives of the industry here today monitoring this, as they have the past Commonwealth Club programs that I participated in with Camilla and with Devra. The party line is basically wireless devices marketed and sold in the U.S. are comprehensively regulated at the federal level and have been deemed safe by federal regulators and other impartial experts. These are really half-truths. There isn't really comprehensive regulation at the federal level if you sort of look underneath the surface, and I'll go into that a little more later. The definition of safety is a circular definition if you look carefully at how it's been defined. It's because this group of people back in the early 90s set standards, but they were by no means impartial experts, one could argue. They were largely people from industry and from the military. And the military has a vested interest in protecting microwave radiation standards from being too stringent because of the radar and other applications of microwave radiation, which we probably know a whole lot less about, but there's been classified research going on for many decades on how to develop weaponry using microwave radiation. If you want to learn more about the industry shenanigans with regard to cell phone radiation, I would recommend, and I'll do an unshameless plug because I have no financial interest in the film. I was one of the co-producers along with Ellie Marks and Deborah Davis, and Kevin Kunz, our videographer today, was the director of the film. I would strongly recommend you take a look at the film Mobilize. Another film, which I have no connection to, Merchants of Doubt, also shows you the kinds of tactics that industry uses to manipulate the media and manipulate journalism. It's a very, very good film. It looks specifically at the tobacco issue and the climate change issue. These are two very recent documentaries I would recommend you all see. Our government position is that devices meet the minimum safety guidelines, but then you have to look at how those guidelines were developed, and you find all kinds of shenanigans occurred many years ago, essentially in the early 90s, when we did have at that time considerable evidence that non-thermal effects existed. There were reports out of the Air Force reviewing the literature showing considerable evidence of non-thermal effects in the early 90s when these guidelines, these standards were adopted. In 2014, the U.S. Department of the Interior wrote a letter to the FCC, actually the Department of Commerce, in which they claim the electromagnetic radiation standards used by the FCC continued to be based on thermal heating, a criterion now nearly 30 years out of date and inapplicable today. The other position of our government is we must wait for conclusive evidence, but in the meantime, they ignore the evidence. And then the hypocrisy of it all is we've made a minimal investment in the research. The one major project that was conceived in around 2000, the National Toxicology Project, has yet to publish a single report, and when it finally does, it will be on an obsolete technology, second generation. So I have 1 minute. Federal government, Radio Frequency Interagency Working Group, I have some slides about that, has been, it's basically a sham, and I can go into that if I had more time. The European Environment Agency is a place to look forward to for policy recommendations, and some of the European, as Mary pointed out, some of the European countries and some other countries have begun to take progressive moves to implement protective legislation. See what's most important to focus on here. I mean, there's been a fair amount of activity at the local level That not much can happen at the federal level because of power of the industry. But even at the state level, they've managed to stop legislation in half a dozen states. AB 57, I suggest those of you in California might want to talk to Ellie Marks about, because there may be a legislation occurring this week, and it needs to be stopped. There's been a lot of work on institutional policies, NGO resolutions from some major organizations, but there's this disconnect between the science, the advocates, and the policymakers. And we need to find a way to bridge that gap. I think it's going to take a multifaceted effort, lots of grassroots organizing, approaching this issue from many directions in terms of litigation, in terms of lobbying legislators. I am not an advocate per se. I've been advising advocates, policymakers, journalists, and the general public around these issues for 6 years now. We just need more bodies, I think, more expertise to approach this issue and collaborate together on this issue to get some movement. Ultimately, at the federal level, it's going to have to happen, but maybe if we make enough noise at the local and state level, eventually that will lead to federal action on this issue. But it's been long overdue. The science is there. The scientific community is largely divided still, in large part because the industry funds most of the current science outside of the U.S. U.S., there's hardly any science going on because our government won't fund it and the industry won't fund it. But outside the U.S., much of the science has conflicts of interest underlying the funding. And that silenced many of the people who would have signed our petition because they simply cannot do that. In some cases, it was on philosophical grounds, but in many cases, it was pragmatic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joel. And now I'd like to invite up all the panelists. Please bring your very lightweight chair with you. We're going to line up here. We've got a number of questions. If there are more question cards that I have not seen, please send them up to me. Thank you. Here we go. We can. You want to move it over a little bit. That's great. Oh, this is Martin.
Big step.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oh my God. We're overwhelmed with questions. Okay, we have. Almost a half an hour, and then we'll need to end at 3:30, and we'll need to be out of the building by 4. So I can tell you already that we're not going to get to all of these questions, but maybe we should commit to what we committed to many years ago, which is to answer them afterwards if we don't get to yours. Okay. Yes, we will be posting it on electromagnetichealth.org as soon as we can, maybe by the end of the week, maybe early next week. Electromagnetic Health, just go to the news section. I'm sure Environmental Health Trust will then eventually also post them, but absolutely, absolutely. And we encourage everybody to share them widely. Okay, this question, and for the panelists, if you could please be really brief and just sort of cut right to the answer, and because we want to get as many questions in as possible. First question for Dr. Dunkley: has the American Psychiatric Association addressed the issue of children and wireless? And there are two. There are some mics. Do you see the mics?
Yeah.
We need to share the mics. Are the mics on?
Yeah, it is working.
Is it working?
To my knowledge, the medical organizations, it's been the American Academy of Pediatrics that has taken more of an active interest, and I believe recently there was a combined statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the APA, as well as the American Academy of Child Adolescent Psychiatry. So I think they all wrote a combined letter. Does someone else know? You know about that, Camilla?
Yeah, there is a letter out there.
Yeah, so I that was the first time in history, actually, that all three medical organizations came together like that to endorse the letter. But I think, so I think they're open to it. I just think they're not all that active about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Dr. Moskowitz, what has been the response to the UN resolution from the UN?
Nada, nothing. We have not heard from them yet. We're currently collecting support from NGOs from around the world. We plan to send that to the UN as well. There's other efforts to support the petition among non-EMF scientists, because the 206 were all people who had published peer-reviewed research on electromagnetic fields and biology or health. But other scientists want to support us. And the health professionals, there's an effort to organize health professionals who want to sign a letter of support. And all of these will be delivered to the UN. The UN and WHO has been almost as bad as the U.S. on this issue.
Okay, thank you.
Addressing the research.
Thank you. Dr. Merritt, why does the U.S. and the U.K. have such a higher rate of radiation, nearly 10 times the amount from the rest of the international community? Dr. Merritt?
I'm not 100% sure what that is relating to. I mean,
maybe the guidelines.
We have higher standards in the U.K., I believe, than in the United States, because the United States and Europe is pretty much following the ICNIP standards, but all of those are thermally based standards. So I think that's all I can really say about that. What we really need is non-thermal standards.
Mm-hmm. This is for Dr. Merritt, Erica Mallory-Blythe, as well as Dr. Dunkley. How can we get EHS recognized as a disability in this country?
Well, it's beginning to be studied now, just as we heard from the University of California in San Diego. The biggest problem has been they've tried to do studies that showed that if people were exposed, that they would have a physiological response that could be actively determined, and some of the time it hasn't been taking place, although there are papers showing that there are neurophysiological effects in people, and they're largely unconscious. Other studies have shown there's changes in heart rate variability and so on. So I think we just need the universities, as is happening now, to start getting behind this, because there's been basically a big wall of denial in the scientific community, and people are suffering. So it's been a grassroots effort.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else on that one?
I'll just mention that there are people in the U.S. that are having disability compensation for EHS as well, but it's based on functional testing. So while there isn't a blanket policy, individuals are getting that support when they're functionally tested.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, I just want to say that the data that Dr. Golem presented, I think, is very important in this context, because what she showed was there are important genetic controls of susceptibility to EHS. And that tells you it's biological, okay? It tells you it's biological. That's very important. Okay.
One quick comment. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles Unified School District, by the way, is the first school district in the country, as far as I know, to offer official accommodations for staff and teachers who have developed electromagnetic hypersensitivity. They don't make it easy for them to get these accommodations, but they are beginning to do this.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried going to the press for the UN letter? And the answer is yes. We've had tremendous, over 100 articles around the world and 40,000 downloads of the press release by the media and continual reading of that press release and watching the video, and we can always do more. For parents that are well aware of the studies on the health effects of EMF radiation, what do you recommend we do when school administration and boards do not listen to our concerns?
That's a very difficult, basically, social and political issue, because the schools are becoming more and more convinced in order to be competitive, they need to be offering the wireless technologies. The same LA Unified School District is almost making it mandatory that a child needs to work with a Wi-Fi tablet and be capable and competent on that kind of device without taking into account any of the health effects from that. So the more data you give to those school boards, they don't seem to really listen to scientific reasoning in this matter. It's really a matter that the teachers and the parents are educated about the potential downside, because they are the ones that are going to be having their children exposed, or they are the teachers, they're getting sick themselves. And that seems to be the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dunkley, can you comment on the...
Let me just pick one remark.
Sorry, go ahead, Lloyd.
School boards are elected. It's amazing how people that are elected, what they're concerned about being in office for the next election, respond.
Dr. Dunkley, no light at night. Does that mean no electric lights?
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting comment from somebody who, a telecom representative's wife suffered a miscarriage twice and had several towers from his own company opposite his house. He shifted to a different place. His wife delivered a healthy baby and then moved back to the old place. He asked me to help him with shielding his house and also offered to give something shielding for his top bosses. But the conclusion was, don't tell the public that you are shielding our houses. And this person said, you mean to say you are ready to kill all the other people while protecting yourselves? I will not shield your house. That's good. Okay, so I see too many parallels between the history of tobacco industry and cell phone industry. Deniability pervades both. What will it take to enlighten the populace? Anybody?
Sickness. Sadly.
Yeah, I keep hearing from journalists it's going to take a huge body count that can't be attributed to something else. I wanted to say something, and this is very important. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last summer put out precautionary warnings for 10 weeks. I was tipped off by an advocate 9 weeks into it. I put out a press release. It got posted all over the world on advocacy sites. It also got covered in the trade press, and a week later, it got pulled down with a very bogus explanation on the CDC website. Deborah Davis, I understand, has done a FOIA request and may have some more insight. Louis Slesson from Microwave News has also covered this issue and can explain how it actually got up there, which is an interesting story in itself. But why it got pulled down, I think, is a major story that the press needs to cover.
Mm-hmm. Elaborate on the melatonin effect caused by EMF, please.
We learned how it came to be effect. Kenneth R. Foster, a longtime industry consultant, was hired by the CDC to come and change the language.
Mm-hmm. Elaborate on the melatonin effect, maybe Dr. Paul.
The melatonin. So first of all, let me just say these fields, the work on the release of all kinds of neurotransmitters and hormones. Okay, so many different types of hormones, and of course, melatonin is a hormone. So the release mechanism is regulated by the VGCCs, and so the fact that it's impacted here should not be surprising. The way in which it's impacted, I think, is complex, because what's been found, and this has been found from, in fact, in some data that goes back to over 50 years, is that the endocrine systems initially become activated, and then over time they become completely exhausted. So they just fail to function at that point. And so I suspect that that's part of the melatonin story, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Victoria.
So I think there's probably synergistic mechanisms going on that suppress melatonin between the radiation and just the light itself. And once the body clock becomes desynchronized, it creates all sorts of other problems. And kids who have autism and ADHD, they already have problems with arousal levels and low melatonin. So it becomes a vicious cycle. But I think using the melatonin argument and the sleep argument, whether we're talking about screen time or radiation, that science is pretty well established. So to me, when I talk to parents about or talk to the school directly, I do emphasize the the sleep effect quite a bit because it makes sense to people.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kaplan, oh, wait a minute, that wasn't for you, sorry. Sorry, that wasn't for you, there's another one here. I think this might be for Carl. What research, if any, has been done on cumulative effects of electromagnetic radiation and cell phone and wireless technology?
That's the real problem. The real problem is that we have only short-term exposure guidelines and no long-term effects. So when I showed the data of how we might start to approach this data by plotting the cumulative exposure over time, that might be a starting point to see. Because we really need those. Even the ICNIP standards don't have any long-term cumulative effects. And Israel is about the only country that has begun to make some policy guidelines in this regard. So we really need this, and we need to start seeing what you're exposed to. As long as we only look at it from a thermal perspective, then you say, oh, there's enough blood flow to that area of the body, it will immediately quench any of the heating effects, and then you're good to go. And it doesn't take into account the long-term biological effects on neural tissues, on hormonal changes. Even this question about melatonin, I look at melatonin and adrenal stress hormones like cortisol, they're like in a teeter-totter, and people are so stressed now, people are sleeping so poorly, people are so overexposed to radio frequency radiation and light that they really can't regulate the normal circadian rhythm, and all the hormones are part of a symphony. So we really need these kind of studies, and we need to have people pay attention to the long-term effects.
Mm-hmm. What should be the message to pregnant women, Dr. Kaplan?
May I just comment on the last
one? Okay.
The Russia and China have both done, as I mentioned, 40 or 50 years' worth of experiments, and many of those are long-term experiments on exposures, and they have found many significant biological effects, and that is why they've set such stringent standards. So the research exists, but a lot of it's in Russian or Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kaplan, what should be the message to pregnant women?
I think the pregnant woman, especially in the hospital during the treatment, should be informed about the exposure. You know, the time of the exposure and the type of the exposure should be given them. And also, child hospital should be safe for the Wi-Fi devices.
What can I do to reduce my symptoms of EHS other than avoidance? Anybody?
My experience with many, many clients is that the people who are electrically hypersensitive also have a large degree of chemical toxicity. And this is borne out by also work by Cyril Smith in the UK, who has studied electromagnetic hypersensitivity with Dr. Ray. And so part of that, besides giving protective hormones, whether it's fish oils or melatonin, as we've seen in these studies, can be helpful, we also really need to recognize to detoxify people. And there are some studies done by the Environmental Working Group. They looked at 10 women and the cord blood of them, and they contained 232 chemicals in cord blood that the baby is fed with. So, you know, there is a significant level of toxicity in almost everybody. The same thing done with fat samples done by the government. So we do need this way of cleaning our bodies from time to time as part of a preventive approach.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Paul, are people using calcium channel blockers?
Let me make a remark. The blood-brain barrier opens up from electromagnetic fields, microwave, thing. So certain chemicals that would never get into the brain are allowed to get into the brain.
Dr. Yeah. Paul?
I think there are a lot of side effects from the calcium channel blockers. They work great in cell culture, but there's serious questions about whether they're going to be useful clinically or not. And so you know, I've talked to people who've said, well, you know, I can use this agent and I get 20% of my patients who respond positively, I get 20% who respond negatively, and the others don't respond. And, you know, sometimes by playing with doses, you can get an improvement in that. But it's not an obvious and a simple magic bullet, let's put it that way.
Is the Baby Safe Project addressing the increased use of ultrasound throughout pregnancy and for non-medical reasons and by non-medical personnel? Lloyd, the Baby Safe Project, is it addressing the use of ultrasound in pregnancy and beyond?
Yeah, I believe it is. I mean, in many ways, you have a developing infant that the cells are differentiating all the time. Exposing them to anything that is not really necessary is, I would think, harmful.
Mm-hmm. Vitamin D reduces inflammation. Could vitamin D protect against effects of EMF? Anybody? Dr. Paul?
I think there had been some comments that it's helpful with diseases that we think are caused by EMFs. It's one of the things I think that can be helpful, yes.
As far as I know, I haven't seen any studies that vitamin directly helps electrical problems, but it's extremely important because I see a very large number of people now with low vitamin D levels in their blood, and that wasn't even addressed 10 years ago as much as it is now in regular medicine. And I think part of it is that if you look up in the sky, there's an awful lot of different chemtrails and other materials that are almost blocking the sunlight, and we need sunlight in order to produce vitamin D, so that may be another factor.
Mm-hmm. The public schools are being required to use technology for standardized testing. Are you sharing your research and professional expertise with the California Board of Education, Governor Brown, and the CTA? California Teachers Association, I presume. Dr. Dunkley?
That's one of the goals for my book, was to provide information to parents and also to teachers and administrators. So on my website, I plan to have a school section that has information that parents would be able to present to the school board. I haven't discussed this directly with the school board, but obviously that would be a helpful thing.
Yeah, please, Joel.
I don't think this works, though.
Yeah, it's worked, but I think
the California Department of Public Health staff and the Environmental Health Investigations Bureau has actually tried to issue a cell phone guidance document since 2007, believe it or not, precautionary warnings for the public. And for some reason, it could never get released, and it's gone through multiple drafts over the years. I got a tip through the grapevine, not directly from staff. So I tried three requests last year, public records requests. Initially, they told me, oh, it'll be another 3 weeks. Of course, this is, you know, how many years later, right? Just be patient, withdraw your requests. And I said, I'll leave it in there. So anyway, by the end of the year, they told me they decided to kill the document. So it's been suppressed under two gubernatorial administrations, this document, which staff was trying to warn the public about. These are MD-MPH types. They even sent it out for external review. CDC reviewed it. They said it was kosher. They still couldn't get it through the political apparatus of the state. So this is how our Department of Public Health protects us.
Please make sure to share the video from today with all your government officials. We'll probably put together a CD if there's interest, because maybe people might use it more if they see it as a CD. Okay, does putting cell phone in airplane mode eliminate EMF?
There are several smartphones these days have several different things, so you can put it in flight mode, you can control the whether it's getting or sending for signals for apps, and you can do Bluetooth as well. To be sure of eliminating all transmissions, you should turn off all three of those if you have those options on your phone. It depends what device you've got.
Most of the time it does turn it off.
Carl? No, Nezrin was going to speak.
He measured the field in plane mode. It has still got EMF, but lower.
A lot of people don't realize that these days the smartphone is often transmitting more in standby than it is when you're using it for a call, because the apps are sending off and bringing in updates. So the more apps you have, and the more if you've got GPS on there, it'll be working away. With GPS and several apps, their social network, it may be working, or is very likely working, harder, transmitting more than it will be during a call. So, yes, if you're not using it, then I'd suggest putting it, turning it off, actually. It's a great way to take control of your life by saying, I'm only going to be online at these hours of the day, and people can just get used to it. Mm-hmm. Carl?
A cell phone has about four different antennas, transmits at many different frequencies. That's why we've seen in women carrying their cell phone in their bra, tumors exactly where the cell phone antenna, say, of an iPhone is. Okay. And that's, that was reported here before. Generally, when you put it in airplane mode, most of these functions shut down. But nowadays, the cell phone becomes the hub for your smartphone interface and all these other things. So until you carry these dosimeters and start measuring what people are exposed to, it's hard to tell nowadays.
Well, I've just been told we have to end. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for your great questions and participation. Many thanks to all the great panelists. What an incredible lineup we've had today. A rock star lineup, racehorses. Thank you very, very much. And look for the video to be ready by the end of the week.
So, a meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.